fuck your story.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
We like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and threaten me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
We have two more hours of this.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 851 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Revolution Sunday, March 3rd, 2024. This is it. This is the final stand, the last stand of Sting as he wrestles his final match tonight, tagging with Darby Allin against the Young Bucks. Very sad to see the end for Sting, but it's time. It is time, and we're going to talk about Sting. I'm going to talk about Revolution. I got predictions and some other thoughts as well. Some notes from Tony Khan's scrum this week. A lot of WWE news as well. A lot of thoughts on this Rock, Roman, Cody situation. We had some big, big developments in that story this week. And other news and notes, including, unfortunately, some deaths in the wrestling world as well. So we're going to get into all of it. I want to say thank you for a huge month of February, our biggest ever. And hopefully we can say the same here for the month of March as we head into WrestleMania coming up in about a month. But I want to say thank you up front to those who supported via PayPal. You can always do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the very top of the page. Thank you to Big B, Brian Becerra, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Undeniable, Samantha Turner, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Road Warrior, Roderick Welch, and Killshot, Keith Hart. Thank you very much. Quick plug here. There is an ongoing Merch Madness sale on Pro Wrestling Tees. You can get 20% off all t-shirts in our Sound Off store when you use the code MADNESS24 at checkout. That's now through tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern, so you don't have a lot of time. ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. You got to type in the full name of the podcast. And also, those who don't know, Becky Lynch, you probably know because she's been talking about it, but Becky Lynch has a new book coming out later this month called Becky Lynch, The Man, Not Your Average, Average Girl. Drops on March 26th. You can pre-order that book right now and get it for free, the audiobook, using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Make sure you get in on this. She did the narration, apparently, for her own book, 10 hours of audio, narrated by Becky herself. If you are an Amazon Prime member, you can get two free books. I like how my balls dropped there. You can get two free books when you use my link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. But whether it's one or two, I don't know why you wouldn't want to get something for free. So go ahead and pre-order the book now before it drops. And also, I want to say thank you to Good Mic Work, Greg Morgan. For those of you who are not familiar with him, check out his channel on YouTube, Good Mic Work. He had me on his show. We did a little collaboration for WrestleMania season. And I was the first person he invited on, which was very cool. We talked about Bret Hart, who of course is one of the many faces I think you could think of as Mr. WrestleMania, because his WrestleMania resume is very impressive and he's had a lot of great matches. And so we decided to rank what we thought from worst to best, all of Bret's WrestleMania matches, where they fell in the list. And I was curious to see how our lists would be similar and how different they would be. And there were some things that surprised me and other things did not. But you can go on his channel and check it out. The entire video, it's about an hour long. Again, Good Mic Work commentaries on YouTube, and thank you very much to Greg for having me on. I know that's something that we've been trying to make happen for a while, so I guess it's our mutual love and respect for the Hitman that finally brought us together. I had the chance to call a sold-out House of Glory Reckoning show last night with JD from NY. Standing room only, and the NYC arena was packed. Always fun when the building is packed. To see Mike Santana successfully defend his HOG World Championship against Penta, who was wrestling on Collision at the same time that he was in the ring wrestling Santana. What kind of black magic is this? We had Mustafa Ali making his House of Glory debut against Alex Shelley. I had the chance to sit down with Ali before the show for a quick interview. You may have seen it on social media. And I asked him not only about his match last night against Shelley, but his match coming up in Philadelphia, WrestleMania weekend against The Amazing Red. The Rascals were back as well, and Danhausen made his HOG debut. He even had Q from Impractical Jokers in his corner as his special guest. That caught us off guard, because that's quite the combo there, Danhausen and Q. Not what I was expecting. And as the commissioner, I have the chance to do some cool things from time to time, and one of those things was introducing the world last night to Pumi Nakuda, the undefeated MMA sensation, 7-0, never been knocked out, never been tapped out, and now he is bringing his talents to House of Glory. I had him sign his HOG contract right there in the middle of the ring. I've got high hopes for this young man. And yes, I have reached that point in my life where I now refer to other people as young man, even though I still look like a young man myself. Or as one person tweeted last night who was in attendance at the show, the commissioner of House of Glory looks like a corporate Orange Cassidy. I'm never going to escape it. I may as well just embrace my alter ego. But the next time we are live on Triller TV will be the Friday before WrestleMania. JD and I will be in Philadelphia. We are hitting the road for a joint show with Wrestling Revolver. Not only will Ali be wrestling Amazing Red that night, but Santana and Alex Shelley will have a match they have agreed to put their respective titles on the line. The world champions of Hog and Revolver. Champion against champion, title for title. And there will be more announced in the coming weeks. We've got Penta wrestling his brother Rey Fénix on Cinco de Mayo. Then we're back on the road in Lowell, Massachusetts on May 25th. That's a Double or Nothing weekend. And there's even more that I can't announce right now. But there are exciting things happening, and I will keep you all posted on what those are. Now, they say they come in threes. We lost three people of note this week from the world of wrestling, and one from the entertainment world, too. So, actually, four. Actor and comedian Richard Lewis died at the age of 76. He had been dealing with health issues for a while now. And I know he announced a couple years ago that he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But it was a heart attack that did him in, ultimately. He's a part of the latest season, the final season, of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I assume he'll be in a few more episodes before the season is over. It's kind of like when Carl Weathers passed away recently, and then I see him all over TV in those DraftKings commercials. Working until the very end, but I was very sad to hear that. Ole Anderson passed away on Monday at the age of 81. He had been diagnosed with dementia. He was in hospice care. He was a member of the Minnesota Wrecking Crew with Gene Anderson and then later on Arn Anderson, one of the great heels of his era, so much so that a crazed fan once knifed him at a show. You know you're getting heat when an old man in the crowd decides to knife you during the show. But he will be remembered by most, I think, as one of the founding fathers of the Four Horsemen, one of the greatest factions of all time, with Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and J.J. Dillon, even though he was not fond of that period in his career. And later, whenever he would do a shoot interview, he never missed a chance to knock Ric Flair and to talk about how much he hated him. Ole hated a lot of people. He was a cranky old man. But he was also a very influential figure in the business because he wasn't just a wrestler, he was a booker as well. For multiple promotions, namely Georgia Championship Wrestling and then Jim Crockett Promotions for a time. And then later on, he headed the booking committee in WCW, which did not last very long before he was fired because the company ended up several million dollars in debt in his short time as the head booker. But Ole was the man who famously or infamously told The Undertaker, before he became The Undertaker, that he would never draw a dime in the wrestling business. Undertaker would go on to draw many dimes. Ole was the man responsible for the terrible Black Scorpion angle after Sting won the world title, where a man from his past started terrorizing him, but he was under a mask and we couldn't tell who it was. It was a big mystery about who the person was. That's because they booked it as they went on, and even they didn't know who it was going to end up being. And then it ended up being Ric Flair, which was ridiculous because people knew that it couldn't have been him the entire time, but it ended up being Ric Flair. But as the story goes on that, you know, Ole pitched that idea as a joke. Jim Herd was in charge at the time. He shot down a whole bunch of Ole's ideas. And Ole got frustrated, so he just pitched it as a joke one day, figuring, well, Herd will turn that down too. But then he ended up liking the idea. And so the Black Scorpion was born, and they were just trying to book it as they went along. He was trying to figure out, where are we going with this? How is this going to end? But another famous story that Ole was involved in was Black Saturday, which is getting a Dark Side of the Ring episode this season, so I'll wait and get more into detail about it then. But the gist of it was that Ole had Georgia Championship Wrestling sold out from under him by the other stockholder, and there were a bunch of stockholders involved, including Jack and Jerry Briscoe. And the Briscoes and a few others, what they did was they met secretly with Vince McMahon about the possibility of selling him their stocks, enough of it that he would take control of the territory. And so them and a few others, they pooled their stock together, and they did. They sold it to Vince. It was a secret deal, and he got majority ownership of the company. But he didn't care about the company. All he wanted was the TBS time slot. It was one of the most coveted time slots in the country. And he wanted that time slot that came with it because that gave him total control over the wrestling landscape on a national level. Black Saturday, that was July of 1984. Vince McMahon debuts his show on TBS, much to the shock and dismay of a lot of the fans who tuned in that day and said, wait, what is this? Why is Vince McMahon on my screen in studio introducing his wrestling? And he maintained that slot for about a year. The ratings fell. Eventually, he sold the time slot to Jim Crockett Sr. for $1 million and famously told him that he would make him choke on that million. And as it turned out, Ole did not take too well to being backstabbed. And according to Gerald Briscoe, Ole hired a hitman to kill him. To kill him and his brother. So, I mean, how true it is, I don't know. But according to him, that's what happened. Obviously, the hit never happened. And the Road Warriors also claimed that Ole promised a bounty to whoever would break either of their limbs, the Briscoes' limbs, in the ring. So he was probably a little sore, I would say, over how that whole situation went down. And then I know Tony Schiavone has talked about, because Tony Schiavone was very sad, very upset about Ole's passing, because Ole is the one who gave him his big break. And he even acknowledged him on Dynamite this week, his passing. But there's also another story where when Ole came face-to-face with Vince and Linda McMahon, I guess probably shortly after the deal was consummated, they must have showed up and, you know, to meet everybody. And Ole basically said to Vince and to Linda, you know, basically go fuck yourselves, which in hindsight, you know, kind of makes him a hero in my book. But, you know, he didn't ingratiate himself very well to the McMahons. And Schiavone claims that years later, Ole regretted saying that. But Ole, you know, he was a great old school heel a little before my time. Again, I can't kind of became familiar with him long after his prime years with the Horseman stuff is when I became familiar with him. But, you know, by all accounts, a very, very good old school wrestling heel. Did not always have the best eye for talent. And was one of these guys who was very resistant to all of the changes that were taking place in wrestling. You know, the business passed him by. He didn't seem to have a lot of nice things to say about people, but he was a character, that's for sure. Then we had Michael Jones, better known to wrestling fans as Virgil in WWE, Vincent in WCW, Soul Train Jones early in his career in Memphis, dressed up looking like Apollo Creed when he came into the territory. He died on Wednesday morning in the hospital at the age of 72. He had people convinced that he was 11 years younger than he actually was. Wiki had his age listed as 1962, but he was actually born in 1951, which means he was 40 years old when he won the $1 million title from Ted DiBiase. He was actually older than DiBiase. He suffered a couple of strokes a few years ago. He also had been battling dementia. Naming him Virgil was a rib, obviously, on Dusty Rhodes, who was the head booker in Crockett Promotions at the time, their direct competition. And then later when he joined the NWO as Vincent, Obviously, that was a playoff of Vince McMahon. And even at the tail end of his run in WCW for a brief period of time, they called him Shane. I think he actually had like three or four different names during his time in WCW. But they called him Vince when he came in, and at some point towards the end, they called him Shane. Before he got into pro wrestling, he did bodybuilding competitions, and that's where he met Tony Atlas, and from there, he ended up training under Afa of the Wild Samoans. How many people has Afa trained over the year? He's still training people. I mean, he only just announced recently that he's shutting down his promotion, his home promotion, WXW, but he's been doing this for decades now. The run that he will most be remembered for is the one that I grew up on, which was Virgil, the manservant of the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. He wasn't just DiBiase's bodyguard. I mean, he would do these demeaning, menial tasks for him, and that was the point. You know, Virgil was there to serve his every need and just serve him, you know, hand and foot, whatever DiBiase wanted, and not speak, because you never heard from Virgil. He just stood there, he mean-mugged the camera, and he was basically the guy that would get bounced around when DiBiase would run away from the babyface. But the point was, it was meant to embarrass him so that one day, when he would eventually break free from DiBiase, they could make a big angle out of it. He could be a big babyface, which for a while there he was. He was part of one of the most famous angles of all time, live on NBC. 33 million people watching that night for the rematch, Hulk Hogan defending the title against Andre the Giant. Andre won the title under dubious means, only to surrender it immediately to DiBiase, who had bought him off. Virgil was there for that. And coming out of that, DiBiase and Randy Savage, they made a lot of money working together that summer. And there's a famous steel cage match they had at Madison Square Garden that summer where, at the finish, as Savage, and I know it's on one of the DVDs they put out, but as Savage is climbing out of the cage, Virgil is climbing up on the other side of the cage to try to stop him from getting out. And a kid, and I'll never forget this kid, he's wearing a bandana. I don't know how old he is, probably like a young teenager, maybe even a little bit younger, but he is scaling the cage right next to Virgil. And he's trying to beat him up and stop him from getting to the Macho Man. See, that's when you know you're good at your job. When you get fans trying to climb the cage to stop you from screwing over the babyface. I don't know what Virgil would have done to the kid had he turned around. I would like to think he would have seen that it was a kid, and he wouldn't have knocked him into the middle of next week and sent him hurling to his demise off the side of the cage. I guess we'll never know, because they got to the kid before Virgil could even react. I don't even know if he felt the kid hitting him. He no-sold it. But DiBiase and Virgil were together for years until the Royal Rumble. In 1991, it was DiBiase and Virgil against Dusty and Dustin Rhodes. And after the match was over, DiBiase yelled at Virgil and told him, pick up the million-dollar belt, wrap it around my waist, right? Threatening to tell the world about his origin story. Need I remind you about where you came from and where I found you? Need I remind you about your mother? And Virgil knelt down, and he picked up the belt, and DiBiase's cackling like he always did. And then, as soon as he turns back around, Virgil blasts him upside the head with the million-dollar belt, and he got a superstar reaction. This was the payoff to what they were building for so long, and Virgil had finally had enough. And they worked a match at WrestleMania 7, but his big moment came later that year. It was at SummerSlam at the Garden, when he beat DiBiase to win the million-dollar title. First time that title had ever changed hands since DiBiase unveiled it. And it was all designed for this moment and for Virgil to be the first man to take it from him. And it just worked. It worked so well. DiBiase won it back from him a few months later. And that was pretty much the peak of Virgil's career. After that, he settled into a middle of the card babyface role. Not that he would not win matches occasionally, but it was lower level matches. You know, for the most part, his job was to put other people over. Although he did get a WWF title match once on TV against Bret Hart. He did get that. But outside of that, he was never pushed anywhere near the level that he was against DiBiase. And he ended up in WCW during the Monday Night War period as the head of security for the NWO, which reunited him with DiBiase. Which was always weird for me to see, because he was also part, everybody was part of the NWO. And he got to hang around all the top names again, like Hogan and Savage. But he was really just a background player. He was there to mostly get beat up and take bumps. He did come back to WWE years later in the corner of Ted DiBiase Jr. He even worked a tag team match on TV with him and did the job. And then DiBiase fired him. He replaced him with Maurice as his new valet, another pairing that went nowhere. He even popped up in the early years of AEW under his Soul Train Jones name when Chris Jericho brought him in as a sidekick. He was doing stuff with the Inner Circle. That was the last time he appeared on national television. It was actually on AEW Dynamite. But after his time in WWE and in WCW, he claimed to have taught math and science at a high school in Pittsburgh. Sports Illustrated years ago did a story on him and said that when they contacted the school that he allegedly worked at, they said they had no record of a Mike Jones or a Michael Jones ever having worked there. So that may have been one of his stories. But the man was a hustler. You know, he did whatever he had to do to make money. He was well known for that. If a fan walked up to him and wanted a selfie, he would charge you for it. You know, at least sometimes he would charge you for it. He would set up shop at some of these conventions. He would offer autographs and photos, even if he wasn't invited. He didn't even need to be booked. He would just show up and set up shop. But, you know, that's where the Lonely Virgil meme comes from. You see photos of him sitting there all by himself with no line. He hustled and he did what he had to do to make money. You know, he took that one brief, you know, big push that he got there years ago, and he tried to parlay it into something that, you know, he can make money off of years later. You know, that's what a lot of wrestlers do. Not every wrestler is a major main event player. There are some people who get over for a brief period of time, or they're, you know, maybe like a mid to upper level babyface or heel, and they'll, you know, do the convention rounds and they'll make the circuit, and that's how they make money. And I feel like these days, because there are so many conventions and virtual signings and things of that nature, that it's probably never been easier for someone like that from, you know, the past eras. Or if you're someone who had like a goofy gimmick or something, and you would think, who would want, you know, to get this person's autograph? Or why would this person be in such demand? But I feel like that's the kind of stuff, like the Shockmaster is probably making a killing when he makes these appearances, because, you know, that's a big thing for people now, and they want to meet the guy, and they want to get their picture with him, and, you know, business has probably never been better for those guys than it is today. But my lasting memory of Virgil will be him whacking DiBiase in the head with that belt, and then winning it from him at Madison Square Garden. They played the long game with that story, and even though it was only a brief period that he was over for, it was a very satisfying payoff. And this week was not done with us yet, because we had one more death to talk about here, which was Paul Butcher Vachon, the father of the late Luna Vachon, brother of the late Mad Dog Vachon. He passed away Thursday night at the age of 86. He technically was Luna's stepfather, and that's a sad story in itself. Luna's biological father killed himself. It was actually in a hotel room one night. Paul happened to be staying at that same hotel. And he was the one who consoled Luna's mother, ended up marrying her, and then adopted Luna. But he had been dealing with a number of health issues in the last several years, throat cancer being one of them, and he had a tumor on his skull that was removed last year. He had lost his ability to speak, you know, more than just a whisper. So he could, what he would do is he would clap to get the attention of the people taking care of him, and there was a Facebook post that I saw from last year where he said he would wink and smile a lot at his wife. They had just celebrated their 30-year wedding anniversary in September. He was a wrestler and a promoter. He and his brother held the AWA tag team titles for a long time. And by the mid-80s, he was working in WWE, pretty much putting people over, putting a lot of baby faces over. But he is most remembered from that run, because, and this is the kind of goofy stuff that they would do back then on Tuesday Night Titans. But on a very memorable edition of Tuesday Night Titans, he got married. We had the wedding of Butcher Vachon, and I remember after the wedding, there was this epic food fight. And Vince McMahon and Lord Alfred Hayes and Fred Blassie, everybody was just covered head to toe in, I guess, pie frosting. They were throwing pies at each other. And actually, there was actually kind of a disturbing moment where this woman, and I say woman, she was under a mask, but she looked like a kid, like a teenager. Some of the wrestlers were throwing stuff on her. And she was grabbing at her and stuff, and she was screaming. And Vince had to come over and rescue her, and he escorted her to the side to get her away from them. That stands out to me. But it was like one big old party. I'm sure there were a lot of parties like that back then in that company, just not with pies. But when I think of Butcher Vachon, that was, you know, I thought, oh, yeah, that's right, he was in the WWE, but it was brief, and that's what I remember him for. And it just goes to show you the power of having national exposure, because you could have somebody like Butcher Vachon, who had years invested in the wrestling business and was this great tag team wrestler with his brother. This guy was a killer, you know, he was so intimidating. Because Mad Dog was actually a small guy. Mad Dog was like 5'7 or 5'8, and Butcher was taller than him. And so you have this image of the Butcher, right? The guy calls himself the Butcher. And then here he goes to WWE, and they're doing this goofy shit with him where he's getting married, and it's very lighthearted, like comedy. But a lot of people are gonna remember the name and know him from that, because their first exposure to him probably was watching Tuesday Night Titans in 1986 or whatever year it was. And it just, again, it just goes to show you the power of having national television and why Vince was so successful. And you have these people and these gimmicks that are still over all these years later. How many people know the Bushwhackers were this evil, violent tag team, and all these other places where they would go and they would maim their opponents and they would have these bloodbaths? Most people, when they think of the Bushwhackers, probably remember them doing the goofy march down to the ring and licking people and yo, yay, you know, that's the Bushwhackers that I knew. I was amazed when I learned that the sheep herders were a thing. I was mortified. I said, wait, how is this the same team? I couldn't believe it. Anyway, a bad week as far as wrestling deaths. Hopefully this week will be a lot quieter than last week was. Let's talk about AEW, because tonight is a big night. And before we even get into the Revolution stuff, there was a story that Mike Johnson broke this week on PW Insider that could affect AEW. More specifically, though, it's about a visa issue, an international visa issue that could impact a lot of big events, WrestleMania weekend and beyond WrestleMania weekend. But this is what Mike said. He said, in a developing situation that could have a negative ripple effect on upcoming events, PW Insider has learned that U.S. work visas for nearly 20 CMLL stars in Mexico are in the process of being canceled by the United States government. Once that happens, it could take months for new visas to go through the approval process and be issued. And they are told that 19 luchadors, including Volador Jr., Hechicero, and Máscara Dorada, who have all appeared recently on AEW TV, and a whole bunch of other names as well, are expected to be impacted and unable to perform in the United States. In speaking to sources close to the situation, the visa blow-up is a result of Texas independent wrestling promotion Full Blown Pro Wrestling, which runs Laredo and who had essentially sponsored the group visas for the CMLL talents, running into issues with CMLL management over the course of the visa process. PW Insider is told that the head of CMLL had placed other employees, one of whom was heading up the legal department for them but has since left the promotion, in charge of the visa process on their end. PW Insider is told that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security contacted the head of Full Blown Pro Wrestling with questions regarding the visas, and that he was informed that he could be accused of fraud if the visas were flagged due to whatever issue it was they discussed. We don't know specifically what the issue was. As the story goes, the full-blown promoter contacted CMLL about working together to iron out the problem, but CMLL's side claimed that they would take care of the issue via the U.S. Embassy in Mexico and would not respond beyond that statement. It should be noted that the Department of Homeland Security, not the embassy for a specific country, actually issues the work visas here in the United States. And PW Insider is told by one source that the belief on the CMLL side was that they would be able to handle it as a family member works for the embassy. Whether that could actually be the case or not remains to be seen. However, with CMLL no longer communicating with the head of Full Blown Pro, but his name remaining on the line legally, the word is that he informed the U.S. government that he no longer had any intentions of working with CMLL going forward, and that any agreements he signed to work with their talents were being terminated as of February 28th. So what this means, according to Mike Johnson, is that unless there is some sort of a miracle at the last minute to work things out, All those talents would not be able to travel into the U.S. legally to perform until a new work visa is issued for each of them. And they are told that such a process could take a few months if everyone involved pays some pretty expensive fees to expedite everything. And that's also assuming everything goes as smoothly as possible. That's a best case scenario, that it would only take a few months. But at times, the work visa process could take upwards of 6 to 12 months. And so you've got a lot of CMLL talents that are advertised for WrestleMania weekend, which is the big weekend of the year. Everybody piggybacks off of WrestleMania. You've got multiple promotions in town in and around Philadelphia that weekend, including a lot of international talents. New Japan has a show coming up next month in Chicago. That's the show where Naito is defending the IWGP title, I believe, against Jon Moxley. So you have a lot of these CMLL guys that are not going to be able to make those dates potentially unless this gets fixed in record time, which seems very unlikely. But the reason that this could also affect AEW is AEW has Forbidden Door coming up in June. And it has not yet officially been announced for Arthur Ashe Stadium. Andrew Zarian reported that a couple of weeks ago. It's going to be at Arthur Ashe in June. And they'll still do their Grand Slam event in September, but it may be in a different venue. But if they do Forbidden Door in June, you know, we've got 2 years of great Forbidden Door shows where it was AEW involvement with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And I'm not saying there won't be New Japan Pro Wrestling involvement at Forbidden Door this year. But the talk has been that there would be more CMLL influence because they just started this relationship. We've seen a lot of CMLL mentions. We had CMLL footage on Dynamite this week of Chris Jericho back in the day when he was working with Atlantis because he wrestled Atlantis's kid on Dynamite this week. So they just started this working agreement. And if they're going to have a heavy involvement in Forbidden Door this year, this could potentially put that in jeopardy. If you've got almost 24 different talents from CMLL that can't travel to work in the U.S., that's a problem. That could potentially be a very big problem, and this may not be resolved by June. So that's going to be something to keep an eye out for, because I know there are, there are a lot of CMLL fans and people who are excited to see them get exposure on TV in AEW. You know, I am not as familiar with their talents as I am, you know, New Japan talents, for example, but there are people who are excited to see CMLL and AEW working together, and this could put a real dent in those plans. So that'll be a story to follow. But tonight is AEW Revolution. On the Revolution media call on Thursday, Tony Khan said that he could see AEW doing 9 to 10 pay-per-views this year, with 9 being the sweet spot. I think 8 would be the sweet spot, but he thinks 9 would make more sense. I guess it makes more sense if he thinks he can make more money with 9. That comes off a report from Fightful this week that AEW has filed to trademark the name AEW Dynasty, which could be the name of a potential pay-per-view this year. And Dynasty got some people talking about Richard Holiday, who made a name for himself in MLW as part of a faction with MJF and Alexander Hammerstone called the Dynasty. He was spotted backstage at Dynamite, it was a while ago, probably last fall. Holiday was spotted backstage and then nothing came of it. But could that be a sign of an upcoming debut? You know, could we see a Dynasty reunion with MJF and AEW when MJF is ready to come back? You know, MJF, he's going to need some friends. If the Undisputed Kingdom isn't dead by the time he comes back, he's going to need some backup. So it's possible. Although if they did some form of a Dynasty reunion, Hammerstone would not be part of it because Hammerstone just signed with TNA this past week. So he'd be out. But Revolution tonight is at the Greensboro Coliseum. They've got over 16,000 plus tickets sold. Basically a sellout for the allotment of tickets that they opened up. A very strong lineup on paper. I would say one of the strongest they've put together in a very long time. The 0 Hour pre-show kicks off at 6:30. The actual pay-per-view kicks off at 8 p.m. But the pre-show starts at 6:30. They have added 2 matches. This is AEW, so by the time you listen to this, they may have added 2 more. But they have a tag team match with Chris Statlander and Willow Nightingale, with Stokely Hathaway in their corner, taking on Julia Hart and Sky Blue. I'm going with Statlander and Nightingale for the win. And then on Collision last night, they added a random 12-man tag team match with the Bang Bang Scissor Gang, Jay White, Austin and Colton Gunn, The Acclaimed, and Billy Gunn, taking on Jeff Jarrett, Jay Lethal, Willie Mack, Private Party, and Satnam Singh. Let's just get everybody on the show. Jay White's crew is going to win this match, because if not, I want to know who's booking this. Is it Tony? Is Tony booking this? Because there's only one outcome to this match. Now, we were supposed to get something on the main card called Meat Madness, after all those meat chants that we got at World's End between Andrade and Miro, or I think there might have been another match too where we got chants like that, but we were going to get Meat Madness featuring Wardlow, Powerhouse Hobbs, and Lance Archer. Two men who can't afford to lose right now, and one who all he does is lose. Which is why I figured Archer was in the match in the first place, was to take the loss. But Tony Khan said that he was planning on adding other ingredients to Meat Madness. And due to certain people not being medically cleared, he will pull Meat Madness out of the freezer and thaw it out at a later date. Oh my God. So instead, they have announced an all-star scramble match for a future AEW World Championship match. And the three men they had already announced for Meat Madness, Wardlow, Hobbs, and Archer, are all in. So whatever injuries there were not injuries to the main three people that were already advertised for the show. So I don't know why they couldn't just proceed with those three, since that's what they were advertising anyway. Miro said that he has been injured since September and he sought medical attention in January. And he was very snarky on Twitter towards Tony Khan in the tweet that he posted when people misrepresented what Tony actually said in his scrum comments when he brought up Miro and Keith Lee, because he wants to have Miro and Keith Lee healthy and available for Meat Madness. And so, you know, they came up in comments. Miro said he was sorry if Tony wasn't aware of the fact that he was hurt. You know, I'm sensing a very big part of why Miro has not been pushed at a high level in a while has more to do with Miro and less to do with his boss. He may be his own worst enemy. I also have no idea how the man got hurt because we never see him in the ring. But, I guess when you only work one match every few months, you may be more prone to injury, I guess. He looked fine to me at World's End against Andrade. I thought they had a great match. So he did a good job of hiding whatever it was he claims is hurting him then. But man, you had Miro working hurt. Keith Lee was obviously working hurt, but they still announced the match between him and Swerve for World's End, and then he couldn't get medically cleared for it. Then he had some kind of double surgery in January for whatever issues were ailing him. You know, Miro had some success as the TNT champion before he disappeared off the face of the earth. Keith Lee had some success as one half of the tag team champions for a while with Swerve. And outside of those two title runs, their time in AEW has been a gigantic disappointment. Now for Miro, I think he may be a big part of the problem more than anything that Tony Khan did with him, and which does not excuse Tony Khan from not trying to come up with stuff for him to do, but there were also stories that he was coming up with stuff for Miro to do, and Miro supposedly was shooting it down. And it's hard to separate fact from fiction when it comes to this guy because there's been so many stories, but I'm getting the impression that Tony Khan may not be the only one to blame for Miro's situation in AEW. And then as far as Keith Lee, you know, a lot of it just comes down to his health. He just has not been able to stay healthy, and it's a shame. It's too bad. But evidently they were going to be included in Meat Madness. There was no way Keith Lee was going to be healthy enough to come back in time for this show if he had double surgery in January. So I don't quite understand this. Unless Tony's been planning Meat Madness for months, it just doesn't really make any sense to me. But now it's Wardlow, Hobbs, Archer, Chris Jericho, Brian Cage, Hook, Dante Martin, and Magnus representing CMLL. This will be my first time seeing Magnus. Magnus is not going to win. I think Wardlow would have won Meat Madness, and I think he still wins this. I mean, how is he going to go out there and cut that promo on TV last week and not win? It's got to be Wardlow. FTR takes on Jon Moxley and Claudio Castagnoli, representing the Blackpool Combat Club. This is coming off their time limit draw last week and their win with Bryan Danielson over Eddie Kingston and FTR on Wednesday. The Blackpool Combat Club are the ones that are at war right now with the CMLL crew. I could see the Blackpool Combat Club and FTR working together after this against the CMLL talents. You know, BCC is wrestling at Arena Mexico at the end of this month, but I think Moxley and Claudio get the win here. Orange Cassidy defends the AEW International title against Roderick Strong, representing the Undisputed Kingdom. I don't think I could say it any more plainly than I did the other night on the stream. If Roddy loses this match and cannot win this championship, then the entire Undisputed Kingdom should be disbanded immediately. There is no other outcome to this match other than Roderick Strong walking out the international champion. Period. End of story. Will Ospreay makes his in-ring debut for the first time since signing his contract, taking on Konosuke Takeshita. Both men are part of the Don Callis family, but will that still be the case when this match is over? Ospreay is not losing his first match in. I can't see that. And I don't expect him to be aligned with Callis coming out of this, or at least not much longer after this. I think the path forward for him is as a babyface. Especially, you look at that reaction he got in Huntsville on Wednesday. It ain't going to be very hard for the fans to embrace him as a top babyface. And not only as a babyface, a top babyface, the top babyface, before this year is over, in this company, will be Will Ospreay. And if I had to pick one match, the one match on this show that I think will be the show stealer, it's this one. And one more note, Fightful is reporting, Fightful Select, that AEW is tentatively planning for Kazuchika Okada, or hoping for him to be part of the Dynamite After Revolution, which is coming up this Wednesday. That does not mean that he cannot be a part of Revolution. Now, if he was, he would probably be overshadowed by Sting's retirement, as most things will be on this show by the time it's over. So maybe they shoot the angle on Dynamite this week where Ospreay gets attacked by the Callis family. Then we hear the coin drop. Out comes Okada to make the save. Because if he's debuting before Big Business in Boston on the 13th, and he's not going to be debuting the same night as Mercedes, maybe he'll have his first match that night. Right? Because they should be announcing some big matches for that show soon. We can get Okada and Ospreay teaming up against Takeshita and Will Hobbs. I think that would be a hell of a first match for him to be involved in. But Will Ospreay is going over on Takeshita. I have him to win. Christian Cage defends the TNT Championship against Daniel Garcia. Christian took out Adam Copeland with a concerto. Garcia got the spot. I know he's got Daddy Magic watching his back, but come on. Come on now. You think that's going to make a difference? Right? They're still outnumbered anyway, right? Christian's got the dinosaur, he's got Nick Wayne, he's got Mother Wayne. Mother Wayne could probably beat up Daddy Magic. Just because Copeland is not on the card does not mean that he will not appear on the show. I think that he will. I think that he will help even the odds. And I think, now I don't know if I'm in the minority on this or not, but I think we're going to get a new TNT champion. I'm picking Daniel Garcia to win the title. I think they're very high on him. I think that title was made for someone like him. And I think Copeland and Christian, they don't need it. They don't need the title to keep their feud going and have their big blow off at Double or Nothing. Eddie Kingston puts his Continental title on the line against Bryan Danielson. And if Kingston wins, Danielson must shake his hand when the match is over. Danielson beat Eddie early in the Continental Classic. Eddie came back. He was the comeback kid. He beat Danielson in the semifinals. He went on to win the entire thing. These two don't like each other. That's the story. They don't like each other. Danielson put him to sleep on Wednesday in a triangle. I expect Eddie to retain here. And Danielson is going to shake his hand when this match is over. You know, Danielson he's winding down as a full-time performer. I don't see him winning any singles gold between now and whatever his match is. I'm still hoping against Nigel at Wembley. Nor does he have to. He doesn't need a championship. It would have been nice for him to get a run with the AEW World title. You know, he had that great Iron Man match, the best Iron Man match of all time against MJF. He never won the title. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that he is content to go out there and have great wrestling matches. like he did with Zack Sabre Jr. a few weeks ago. He's probably got some names in mind that he wants to work with, and his goal here between now and the end of his full-time run is to go out there and just have great wrestling matches. And that's great. You know why? Because Bryan Danielson is a great wrestler. And that's what he will go down as. He will go down as one of the great technicians in wrestling history when all is said and done. That's what he's known for. That's what made him famous in Ring of Honor. That's what got him over, was his work in the ring, bell to bell. And so if that's the way he wants to wind down his career, he wants to work people like Zack Sabre, he wants to go to Mexico and work Blue Panther or whoever it is that's on his bucket list of people to work with, I think that's fantastic. I don't think he needs to win the Continental title. Timeless Toni Storm defends her AEW Women's World Championship against Deonna Purrazzo. There are two names that I see potentially being the ones to dethrone Toni Storm, and neither of those names are Deonna Purrazzo. One of those names is Mariah May, because they're kind of doing this low-key story with her. I could see her eventually being the one to beat her and take the title. The other name is Jamie Hayter, and I have not heard a peep about her return. So either she is still hurt, and it's going to be a while, or they're doing a very good job of keeping it under wraps, and they'll make it a big surprise when she pops up one night. The sooner the better. I can't wait to get her back. She was on such a tear before she got hurt. It sucks that she got hurt when she did. But it's one of those two, I think, that take the title from Toni. I don't see it being Deonna. I have Toni winning here. And this is a big opportunity for Deonna, too, because she has yet to, you know, in her brief run, she hasn't been with them for that long, but in her brief run so far, she has yet to have that one match that just sort of wows you. It hasn't happened yet. Tonight is her first real chance to go out there in a big spot and prove to people why she was such a big deal in that women's division in TNA, which she was. And she spent a lot of time there, former Knockouts champion, really made a name for herself there. And tonight she's got a big opportunity in the ring with Toni. Samoa Joe defends the AEW World Championship in a three-way match against Hangman Adam Page and Swerve Strickland. Swerve. There was a swerve, all right, but it was from Hangman on Dynamite on Wednesday when it looked like he was going to not be able to partake in this match tonight, that he was hurt, he suffered an injury, he came out on crutches. And then by the time that segment on Wednesday was over, he smashed that crutch right over the back of Swerve's head and knocked him out. So he's healthy, and he'll be there tonight challenging for that championship. Why did they do the swerve? There were reports that there was a personal issue, some kind of family issue. He wasn't sure if he was going to be able to make it to the pay-per-view, and so they constructed this whole angle where they could at least explain why he wouldn't be there if it turned out that he couldn't work the show. How true that is, I don't know, but that was the story that was going around for why they did what they did. In any event, they're all going to be there, and Samoa Joe, I believe, will still be the AEW World Champion by the time this show is over. Again, everything on the show is going to be overshadowed by Sting's retirement. This show is not about the AEW World title. It's really not. I mean, it's one of the features of the show. Will Ospreay's first match officially under contract, that's a big part of tonight's show. But tonight is about one man. Tonight is about Sting. And I think that if you are going to do an AEW world title change, it should be in the main event. And this match is not the main event tonight. This is the co-main. This is going on before the main. But Samoa Joe deserves more time with this title. I think he's been fantastic carrying that championship these past couple of months. He hasn't had it for very long. This may be the last run that he gets. I didn't even think we were going to get this run. I want him to hold that title for a little bit longer. At the earliest, Double or Nothing, I could see him dropping it to Swerve, but not tonight. And as far as the finish, you know, with Hangman in there, I've been saying it for weeks. Hangman, I think, is more obsessed over making sure that Swerve does not win the title than he is with himself winning the title back. And that will play into the finish of this match. There is going to be some kind of a spot, whether it ends by pin or submission, where Hangman is going to take the loss, but he may take the loss intentionally just to make sure that Swerve does not win that title. That protects Swerve because he doesn't have to be the one to take the losing fall, and it furthers the story with him and Hangman, because eventually when Swerve does win that championship, we're going to come back around to Swerve and Hangman. We're going to get a title match between those two. Like, this story is not ending tonight, regardless of what happens between the two of them. But Samoa Joe is going to retain his AEW World title. And then in the main event, the true main event of tonight's show, Sting wrestles his final match after a nearly 40-year career. It all comes to an end tonight, tagging with Darby Allin to defend the AEW World Tag Team titles against the Young Bucks. Sting and Darby come into this match undefeated as a team in AEW. They come into this match as the tag team champions. Sting came out on Dynamite on Wednesday doing something that we have not seen him do in almost 25 years. Sting rappelled from the ceiling. He rappelled from the rafters on Dynamite in the long trench coat. People went nuts for it. It transported them back to their childhood. It felt like 1997 all over again. And it made me a little uneasy because we have not seen that since what happened in 99 with Owen Hart. And we know what happened there. And yes, accidents happen, but it's the worst accident to ever happen in the history of this fucking business. And it's something that I will never forget. Having been watching the show live that night, it was a horrible night. And I don't see how you can watch that and not be reminded of that. And I said this on a Wednesday. I said, I hope, not that he has to, but that Tony Khan conferred with Martha because they're working with Owen's widow. Right? They're hosting the Owen Hart Cup every single year. They're working with the family. And so out of respect, I would hope and imagine that he must have given her a heads up. And Fightful learned this week that AEW and Tony Khan did confer with Martha Hart regarding the rafter entrance, and Martha gave her blessing. Did they need Martha Hart's blessing? Absolutely not. Tony Khan can do whatever he wants, but I think that's a class move on his part. I was very happy to hear that. I was disappointed at first that we did not get that one final Sting promo to hype the match. But I went back and I rewatched the segment that he and Darby did the week before, that pre-tape that they did, where Sting talked about his father having just passed away 7 days earlier, and he looked into the camera, he had that dead stare. It was like the most serious promo I've ever seen him cut. I honestly think that was one of the, if not the best promo of his entire 40 years in the business. And so there was no topping it, the emotion of that, just the way it came off. So I was okay with it in hindsight because that was kind of the money promo right there, and we got it the week before. I'm sure we're going to hear from him after the match is over tonight, but I'm okay if that's his final promo because it was so good. And I'm sure all that real emotion played a big part in it. I would love to see Sting go out with a win tonight. That's what I would like to see. But he's an old school guy. And I think that if what everybody is saying, including Darby, is true, which is that Tony Khan is being very deferential to him and he is allowing Sting to go out the way that he wants. He is allowing Sting to craft his own story and go out the way that he wants, working against the people that he wants to work against, doing what he wants to do. I see Sting being the kind of guy that would want to put somebody else over on the way out. And I think he takes his first loss tonight and the Bucks walk out the new tag team champions. Because yes, Sting could win and then you could vacate the titles and the Bucks could end up with them anyway. But instead of going through the whole rigmarole, I think that Sting will go out, you know, on his back. Whether it's him or Darby, I think they lose and the Bucks win the belts. Now, when I think back on Sting's career, I mean, what, you know, there's so much to unwrap when it comes to this man's career. As somebody who grew up watching WWF mostly, yeah, I was aware of the NWA, I was aware of WCW. In those early years of my fandom, I wasn't like actively watching it as much, and I started to watch more and more as I got a little bit older. But when I think of Sting, I got that image of Surfer Sting with the colored face paint. You know, you think of Sting, what do you think of? You think of him fighting Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen. Him fighting the Great Muta. Him fighting Big Van Vader. I mean, think of all the people that this man has worked with, worked programs with, all the legendary feuds. From Flair and the Horsemen to the Great Muta to Vader to Hollywood Hogan in the NWO. Kurt Angle and AJ Styles in TNA, he had very good matches with them. His one lone WrestleMania match against Triple H. At least he got a WrestleMania match. And now the Young Bucks in AEW. Like, this man's career has spanned generations. And you're not going to hear his name mentioned very often on people's Mount Rushmore. I should know because God knows I've been asked the question a million times and people have offered me theirs. And I never see Sting's name on there. He didn't influence the business in the way that Hulk Hogan did or Steve Austin did. And he didn't go out there and have the best matches like Ric Flair or Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels. Not that he didn't have great matches, but when you're thinking of the elite, as far as influence the business or the elite in terms of best matches bell to bell, you will not find Sting's name number one and probably not top three or even top five. He may be on the list, but he's not at the very top of those lists. And then you factor in that I think him waiting too long to join WWE, where he would have had so many great names to work with in the early to mid 2000s, it's just ridiculous. There's a lot working against him to call him the GOAT. But Sting is in the conversation when it comes to the all-time greats, because he did influence a lot of wrestling fans who grew up with him as their favorite. Either Surfer Sting or Crow Sting. He had these two very distinct periods in his career. It's like Hogan. You had babyface, all-American, real American Hulk Hogan, who set the world on fire and helped Vince McMahon take his company from what it was to what it would become. You know, without Hogan being there when he was and the whole Hulkamania boom, who knows where WWE is today? You know, it's like Hulkamania had to boom so that the people that came later on in those top spots, whether it be a Shawn Michaels or a Steve Austin or a John Cena or a Roman Reigns, so they could exist in the world in which they exist, right? It all stemmed from that big national expansion with Hogan in the 80s. So you have that version of Hogan, but then you have in WCW when he went heel. You had evil Hollywood Hogan, who took the NWO and took that company from number two to number one. Because without Hogan, they don't become number one for those 83 weeks. And then from that, we got Diamond Dallas Page, who got over. And we got Goldberg, who got over in a massive way. But it was that Hogan turn, which is what the NWO needed, because the NWO with anybody else would not have been as successful. But you have these two very distinct periods of this man's career. It's a similar thing with Sting. You can't say he was as influential as Hogan. But these two very distinct periods where, you know, people look back very fondly on them. And few people that I can think of can match this man's longevity. I mean, think of all the different people he's worked with over all these years and all these different promotions. He's been going strong since 1985. And not that he hasn't had some injuries or surgeries over the years, I'm sure he has, but outside of when he got hurt against Seth Rollins, and that was a pretty serious injury, it's not like you always heard about Sting constantly getting hurt and having these injury comebacks like you did with The Undertaker. You know, Hogan obviously had the severe back issues. He's had a gazillion back surgeries over the years. For a guy that's been doing this as long as he has, I have to say, Sting and Flair. Flair's another one. I don't know what these guys are made of, but they lasted a very long time actively in this business with very few serious injuries, all things considered. So his longevity has been very impressive. Sting is the last of a dying breed. And that's what makes it so bittersweet to see him step away tonight. But the man turns 65 years old in a few weeks. He can collect Social Security right now if he wants to. You know, in the interview he gave to Sports Illustrated the other day, he said he's going to wrestle a certain way tonight. That people, it's going to make people want to, in his words, save the tape. As if people still tape things anymore, right? He's an old man. All that to say, he's an old man. He may not look it. He looks good for his age, but he's an old man. The time is right for him to step away, but I'm still going to be sad when it happens. Now, back in October, when Sting made the announcement that he was wrestling his final match at Revolution, I put together a list of his 10 best matches in ranked order, and I wanted to share that with you again here. It's a quick listen. It's not even 10 minutes, but these are, in my opinion, the 10 best matches of Sting's career. A career that I think saw his best in-ring work come in the late 80s, early 90s. Really through, I would say, 1993, I would say was peak Sting. These are the 10 best matches of Sting's career that you should go seek out and watch. This is my list, and I have ranked them in order from least to best. His TNA match with Kurt Angle from Bound for Glory 2007, where he won the world title, it does not make my top 10, but it does get an honorable mention, especially for the baseball bat shot to the face that Sting took. He took a baseball bat to the face and completely no-sold it like a boss. Kurt swung the bat at his head. Sting was supposed to catch the bat, but it went right through his hands and it busted him open. I'll never forget the sound that it made when it hit him in the face. I have no idea how he didn't go down. I have no idea how he didn't get knocked out. But Kurt had a look on his face like he just shit his pants. He couldn't believe it. So I did want to mention that. But let's start with number 10. Sting against the Great Muta at the Great American Bash 1989. They went less than 10 minutes. But for a sub-10 minute match, you will not find much better than this. This was really good. Number 9, Sting against Ric Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight title at Great American Bash 1990. This was after Sting returned from his knee injury. He finally won the world title. Big pop for the finish when Flair went for the figure four. Sting pulled him in for the small package and got the pin. Number 8, Sting against Diamond Dallas Page on Monday Nitro, April 26th, 1999 for the WCW World title. I didn't like much about WCW after 1998, but this match right here, and their Nitro match the previous year, which had the same finish, but this was the better of the two matches. They went like 20 minutes, and this was the better of the two matches. DDP goes for a diamond cutter out of the corner. Sting's holding onto the ropes. Page is trying to pull him out for a diamond cutter. He tries once, he tries twice, and as he goes for a third attempt, Sting counters into a scorpion death drop, and he drops him, and he wins the championship. This was only 15 days, 2 weeks, after Page won that title for the very first time, and he loses the championship to Sting. And it wasn't even the main event. They ruined it later in the show by having DDP win the belt right back in a four-way match. And DDP told me when I had him on the podcast, that was a Dusty Rhodes call. That was a Dusty Rhodes idea to do it that way. But this right here is the best Sting match from the Crow era. If you were wondering, since he put the Crow face paint on, what's the best Sting match? This is it right here. So I'm talking late era WCW, his entire TNA run, anything he's ever done in AEW. From that Crow era, this is the best match of his career. Number 7, Sting against Vader, Big Van Vader, for the WCW World Heavyweight title at the 1992 Great American Bash. Vader beats Sting to win the world title. This was the first in their classic trio of matches. I loved all of the Sting and Vader matches. For my money, Sting and Vader, best WCW feud of that early 90s period. They worked so well together. Sting against Vader really was the best thing about early 90s WCW. Number 6, Sting against Cactus Jack from Beach Blast 1992, the match that Mick Foley thought was the best match of his career until Mind Games came along against Shawn Michaels, and then that became the best match of his career. And I can't disagree. This was an excellent match. It was non-title, but it was an excellent match. Number 5, Sting against Ric Flair for the first Clash of the Champions in 1988, their 45-minute draw for the NWA World title. This is the match that put Sting on the map and made him a star. I don't think it is his best match, but it is top 5, and it's historically significant for obvious reasons. Number 4, Sting against Big Van Vader in the finals of the King of Cable tournament at Starrcade 1992. What a surprise, another Sting and Vader match. Number 3, Sting and Lex Luger against the Steiner Brothers at Super Brawl 1991, a fantastic tag team match. Nikita Koloff runs down to the ring with a chain around his arm. He goes to bash Luger with it. Sting shoves him out of the way, though, and takes the bullet himself. Number 2, the best of all the Sting and Vader matches, their White Castle of Fear strap match at Super Brawl 1993. Forgetting the embarrassing White Castle mini-movies and just focusing on the match itself, I love this. It's one of the best strap matches you'll ever see. And the number 1 best match of Sting's career is the best War Games match of all time from Wrestle War 1992 with Sting's Squadron. He led his own squad with Ricky Steamboat, Dustin Rhodes, Barry Windham, and Nikita Koloff against the Dangerous Alliance with Steve Austin, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, Bobby Eaton, and Larry Zbysko. Three of Sting's best ever matches came from this year, 1992. 92-93, Sting was prime Sting in the ring. Sting in the ring, that could have been a pay-per-view. Ric Flair was gone. The Four Horsemen were no more. Enter Paul E. in the Dangerous Alliance. And for the finish here, Rude removed the turnbuckle from the ring post. Zbysko tried to hit Sting with the metal piece, but he hit Eaton instead, his partner, which led to a win for Sting's team. That began the downfall, the descent of the Dangerous Alliance. War Games was a whole different beast back then than it is today, which is not to say that there aren't any quality War Games matches today or that they can't be, but you will not find one of better quality than this one. And 91 comes close. The one from Wrestle War 91 is pretty close. It's right behind this one, but I think 92 edges it out. And this right here is Sting's best match. And all of these can be found on Peacock. Or if you're international, I guess it's still the WWE Network in some places. So if you've never seen them before, and frankly, even if you have, go back and check them out. They're well worth your time. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. I recently bought a retro handheld device. Lets me play thousands of old video games on it. And it's smaller than the size of my hand. This thing is incredible. But you can best believe that I am taking good care of this thing. I've got my case. It came with a screen protector. Because it might be okay without that stuff, but the minute the screen gets scratched up, I'm going to regret that I didn't do all I could to protect this thing. It's a lot like going online without ExpressVPN. You might be okay without it, but all it takes is one problem, and you're going to be kicking yourself that you did not protect yourself from the very start. Every time you connect to a network that's not encrypted, in a cafe somewhere, at the airport, in your hotel room, your data is not secure. Anyone with enough know-how on that same network can easily steal your information, and that includes passwords and important financial details. It doesn't take much knowledge to do it. A teenager could do it. And your data is valuable. Hackers can make up to $1,000 per person selling your info on the dark web. So why should you be using ExpressVPN? Because it creates an encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet, so hackers can't steal your sensitive data. It's also easy to use. Just fire up the app and click one button to get protected. That's it. And it works on all devices like phones, laptops, tablets, so you can stay secure while you're on the go. The thing I love the most about ExpressVPN and really appreciate is just how easy it is to use. I don't even have to think about it. I just click one button and it takes care of the rest for me. And that's important to me because I do so many things online. If any of that was compromised, it would be a huge headache to have to deal with all that. Now I don't need to worry about it. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster, and you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. We had some big developments this week in the storyline heading into WrestleMania between The Rock, Cody Rhodes, and Roman Reigns. The Rock dropped a bomb on the two of them this week, a 21-minute social media promo that he dropped before SmackDown on Friday, longer than he would have been allowed on TV and with more profanity and a lot more attitude than Fox would have ever allowed on TV. That was evident by all the censoring on Friday night. They practically butchered that opening segment, all because there was a fan in the crowd with a Die Rocky Die sign. If Die Rocky Die gets the show blacked out, the entire Attitude Era would have been nothing but a black screen. But let's start with this social media video, which did not air on TV, but it did help fill in some important gaps in their storytelling with The Rock and Cody stuff. And I'll paraphrase some parts because he repeated himself a lot. Rock does that a lot in his promos. He'll say the same thing three or four times, like he's trying to buy time to figure out or remember the next thing he's going to say. But he started out by talking about what a big week it was in the world of pro wrestling. Says it's been a big week in the world of WWE. It has been a big week in the world of The Rock, in the world of the People's Champion, in the world... I mean, he just goes on and on here at the beginning. Pro wrestling is back on top and it feels good. It feels good. But you know what? You know what? By the way, that's not a misprint. That's exactly what he said. I told you, he repeats himself a lot. That's why it's 21 minutes. If you took out all the repeating in this promo, it would go from 21 minutes to 12. He said, here's the thing. You know what doesn't feel good? Well, The Rock will tell you what doesn't feel good. What doesn't feel good is all the bullshit that The Rock has had to deal with. All the bullshit that the People's Champion has got to deal with. All the Cody crybabies out there still running their mouths. That The Rock has got to deal with. All the jabronis in the locker room running their mealy mouth that The Rock has still got to deal with. Cody crybabies, take a look. And what he did in different parts of the promo here was he spliced in footage. And the footage he spliced in here was a clip of Dave LaGreca from Busted Open Radio. In his bathrobe, by the way, looking like my Aunt Edna. If I actually had an aunt named Edna, which I don't, but if I did, she would look like Dave LaGreca in this clip. Dave said, you know who is my favorite wrestler right now? It's Cody Rhodes. Do you know who I hate and I fucking despise in this moment? It's Dwayne Johnson, member of the board of directors of TKO. I hate that man right now in this moment, not as a person, obviously, but as a wrestling fan watching the product. The person I want to boo, the person I hate the most, is Dwayne Johnson, board of directors of the WWE and TKO. That's who I am angry at right now, because I am looking at the board of director that came in, used his power to take this opportunity away from Cody and put himself in the main event of WrestleMania 40. That's how I look at it right now. So Dave in his bathrobe, that was a clip from several weeks ago. Back to The Rock. The Rock doesn't know who that guy is, but he knows what he is, and that's a goof, an idiot, another pro wrestling Cody crybaby jack-off idiot who thinks he knows everything but doesn't know shit. A guy sitting in his basement with a bathrobe and a Cody Rhodes t-shirt on, and he's talking about how much he hates The Rock. You don't give that guy a podcast, you give him a straitjacket. Which is actually a pretty good line. How much he hates The Rock. You hate The Rock? It has nothing to do with the board. The Rock will get to that in a second. It has everything to do with common sense, you idiot. You goof. And all the Cody crybabies, who are grown-ass men, who think you know it all when you don't know shit, you listen to The Rock right now. It has nothing to do with the board. It has nothing to do with the fact that The Rock owns everything as it relates to The Rock. The People's Champion. Full ownership. Which means The Rock is the boss. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with common sense. Let The Rock drop some gospel on you. When Roman Reigns, years ago, drops the words head of the table, those words were specifically and solely set up and created so that one day, Roman Reigns, the champion of the WWE, would come face to face with his cousin, The Rock, the People's Champion, and together, combined, they would make history. The biggest WrestleMania of all time. The biggest match of all time. The biggest match in the history of professional wrestling. When Roman Reigns said those words, that's why he said it, because that is Roman Reigns' story, and that is The Rock's story. At one time, that was Cody Rhodes' story, but that was last year. And what happened last year at WrestleMania? What's the technical term? Oh, he shit the bed. That's what happened. And then The Rock comes back on January 1st. It's a big year. You know it. The Rock knows that it's an exciting year. You can feel it in the air. The Rock goes out there in front of that crowd in San Diego and said exactly what he promised he was going to say. Because we had an agreement. That agreement was The Rock was going to go out there. He was going to test the waters. And he was going to see how the crowd reacted. Where should The Rock sit? Should The Rock sit at a booth? Should The Rock sit at the bar? And then The Rock says that should he sit at the head of the table? And the crowd that night exploded. And just as sure as The Rock has chills on his arm, the world exploded because they knew that after all these years, they were finally getting The Rock against Roman Reigns, the biggest WrestleMania of all time. And then what happens? Cody Rhodes wins the Royal Rumble. He works his ass off and he wins the Rumble. Yeah, he's going to WrestleMania. Good for him. The Rock was happy. But what happened? The Rock called Cody Rhodes. I had a conversation, but it was a conversation that a few have had with Cody before, because Cody knew the biggest match of all time was looming. The Rock called Cody and said, Cody, you know, you love this business. The Rock loves this business. You were born into this business. The Rock was born into this business. Roman Reigns was born into this business. You got the biggest WrestleMania main event of all time right here. You have an opportunity to bring this business up to places that it's never been before. You can always, with all due respect, finish your story another time. You agreed. Rock, it stings. It stings. But I'm a team player. It stings. But I want what's best for business. Good man. And then what happened? In Birmingham, Alabama, the city we selected because of its rich history. It was your job to introduce The Rock, setting up the biggest main event of all time. And what did you do? You did exactly what we agreed on. You introduced The Rock. And the place went crazy. And The Rock came out. He dapped you up. He pulled you in. He gave you a big hug. And I whispered something in your ear. Let's put on the biggest WrestleMania of all time. Let's do it for the American dream. Let's do it for the soul, man. And I gave you a hug. You hugged The Rock back. And what did you do? You walked out of that ring on live TV. You turned back. You looked at The Rock, and instead of looking at The Rock saying, yeah, go get him, let's make history, instead of that, what did you do? You gave The Rock a look. It's the same look you gave the world, like The Rock went out and ran over your goofy-ass dog. That's the look you gave, like The Rock ran over your goofy-ass dog. There's a goofy-ass dog outside my window right now. You might hear him every now and then. I am thankful that they filled in the blanks here. This is the one thing that I was waiting on, the one thing I was hoping that they would take the time to do, and to his credit, Rock tried to fill in the gaps as best he could here in this video. From the moment that it happened, it has been the most glaring omission from this storyline for a reasonable, rational explanation for why Cody Rhodes would agree to step aside and let The Rock take the match that he worked so hard to get, the rematch with Roman Reigns, why he would just step aside and do what he did. Now, at Elimination Chamber, it is worth noting that last weekend, when he was on Grayson Waller's show, Cody said that one thing Rock would not want to talk about is the conversation that they had that led to Cody stepping out of the WrestleMania main event, only to then walk back into it. He said that, and then didn't expand on it beyond that. But he implied, the implication, was that it was something that Rock really would not want revealed. And nothing Rock said here in this video when he explained things is really anything that he would be ashamed of or wouldn't want revealed publicly. So there may be more to this. We have to wait for Cody's response this week. Is Rock lying? Or, you know, not telling the whole story? Because if so, then Cody can help fill in some more of those blanks on TV. You know, maybe Rock told Cody that he needs to stop Roman. Right? Not just that I want to wrestle my cousin, big business and all that, but maybe he said, I got to be the one to stop this guy. Maybe it has less to do with family and more to do with Rock wanting to show Roman who the real head of the table is. I think that's going to be the story anyway when they eventually get to Rock against Roman, but maybe that's what Rock doesn't want Cody to reveal publicly. Either way, I appreciate that they took the time, Rock took the time to come up with something reasonably logical to try to explain what happened here. It's still silly to me that Cody would have so easily stepped aside because, you know, best for business or not, there's no other top star in the history of this company, except maybe John Cena, since he was always the consummate, you know, company guy, who would have stepped aside in a situation like that the way that Cody did. I mean, picture most of the top names in the history of this company. Would they do what Cody did in that situation? Would their character step aside and do what he did? I can't see it. But this is as good of an explanation as they could have tried to come up with for this. Now, Rock's promo continued. This was hardly the end of it. He said, and then, sometime from that moment on until Las Vegas, you changed your mind. You know what? That's no problem. You can change your mind. You have that right. And The Rock accepts that. Everybody has a right to change their mind. The Rock accepts it. You changed your mind. Yes, Rock, he changed his mind. But here's what The Rock doesn't accept. It's how you did it. I'll say it again because it's important. To all the Cody crybabies and all the goofs out there, all the idiots who still complain, Cody, you had a right to change your mind. You won the Royal Rumble, but what The Rock doesn't accept is how you did it. I saw you in Las Vegas. I saw you in Las Vegas, saw you backstage 20 feet away. Rock dapped you up, gave you a hug. Did you say anything to The Rock then? Hey, Rock, I got something on my mind. Yeah, tell me more about it. Hey, Rock, I got something that's eating me up inside. Ah, Cody, go ahead. Tell me about it. Let's walk over there. Let's talk in private. come and tell me about it. Did you say any of that? No, you didn't say a thing. But what did you do? You waited until Roman Reigns walked out and announced that he's facing The Rock. And then The Rock went out there, showed the entire family tree, proof of the most dominant family in professional wrestling, in entertainment, in sports. Roman Reigns accepted the challenge, blood oath. We were going to put on the biggest WrestleMania of all time. What did you do? You came out and you interrupted. You said it was bullshit. Yeah, bullshit. You can think it's bullshit, brother, not a problem. But you know where you're really screwed up? It's when you talk shit about my family. All the Cody crybabies. No, he didn't. No, he didn't. Shut your mouth. You talk shit about my family. What'd you call them, Cody? And then they showed the clip of Cody saying that it's not a family. It's just a bunch of lackeys and yes men. They're goons. Then you spoke about Roman's grandfather. You spoke about my grandfather, the great high chief, Peter Maivia. And they showed Cody saying that if your grandfather was here, if the high chief was here, they would be ashamed of you. He said, I did to you, Cody Rhodes, what I would do to you a million times, which is slap the taste right out of your mouth. And then what happened? Did Rock embarrass you in front of the world, boy? Slap the shit out of you? You had it coming. Talk shit about my family again. Said it to you then, I'll say it again here. I'll say it forever. Talk shit about my family again and I'll do worse than that. But then what happened? Your new best friend. You got a new best friend, how about that? Your best friend, the walking clown show, known as Seth Rollins. What did Seth do? The Rock slaps the shit out of you, Seth steps to The Rock. The Rock pushed him back, gave him a little love tap. The Rock doesn't know you, you don't know The Rock, but you don't want to know The Rock in that way. This is none of your business. The Rock doesn't know Seth Rollins, never said a word about Seth Rollins, publicly or privately. The Rock has no idea why this man is getting in our business, but he did. And not only that, but then, he just can't help himself. Like a lot of the jabronis in the locker room just can't help himself. And starts talking shit about The Rock. And then they had clips of Seth doing media interviews saying, yeah, you know, he's going to run his mouth. He's going to say the same crap that he's been saying for 2 decades because he can't come up with new material. And then he talked about how, you know, this is our story. It's our era. We built the last decade of WWE. WrestleMania, the biggest ever. We built it without him. So he can come in and get what he wants. He can get a little piece. And then he can go back to Hollywood and do his thing because we've got this. We don't need you, big guy. Back to The Rock. He says, you don't need The Rock. Rock, we don't need you. If you were a little smarter, Seth, you'd realize how stupid you sound. Let The Rock drop some gospel on your goofy ass. You need The Rock in ways you can't even imagine. You think when Ari Emanuel, The Rock's good friend, The Rock's business partner for decades, The Rock's lead agent, someone who The Rock looks to like a big brother, you think when he goes to sit with Netflix across from Ted Sarandos, The Rock's good buddy and business partner, sitting across from Bella Bajaria, The Rock's good friend and business partner at Netflix, you think when they're inking, signing this $5 billion deal for WWE and Netflix, do you think that Ted and Bella are saying, hey, Ari, when WWE comes to Netflix, is Seth Rollins going to be the champion? You think that's what they're asking? No, they're not asking that. Number one, because they don't care. And number two, because they don't know who the hell you are. You know what they're asking? Hey, Ari, we'll sign this $5 billion historical deal. But one question, where's the people's champion? Poor Seth Rollins, buried again. I didn't think it was possible to bury this man in that belt any further beneath the ground than they did a few weeks ago, but they keep digging, and they keep digging that hole deeper and deeper. Rock said, one question, where is the man, The Rock himself? One question, where's the man who has the most watched film in the history of Netflix? The Rock. Where's he at in this whole deal? Ari looks at them and says, he's locked in for life. Director of the board, owns everything as it relates to his name. Signed, $5 billion. So Seth Rollins, you understand now how much you need The Rock. You understand now, right, boy? You keep running your mouth. You find some new material, Rock. Find some new material? Is that right? Okay, well, The Rock has some new material for you. How about this? The Rock sits at the top. Director, TKO board, Not WWE, but TKO, which means The Rock is the boss, which means The Rock is your boss, which means The Rock owns everything. And then he talked about how Rollins, if you keep running your mouth and sticking your nose in bloodline business, that world title that you have around your waist, very soon, The Rock will make that title go to somebody else. Read between the lines, Seth. Keep running your mouth. This is between The Rock and Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes. That's it. Stick your nose where it doesn't belong, and The Rock guarantees you. He has built a career on doing everything he has said he is going to do. He guarantees you that world title that you have around your waist is going to go to somebody else. And there's two things you can do about it, Seth. Nothing and like it. So think about this. Because I think that line was also very important. If Seth were to defend the world heavyweight title, and we're going to get to what happened with the announcement on SmackDown with Night 1. But we know Seth is pulling double duty as Cody is now at WrestleMania this year. If Seth were to defend his title earlier the same night as the tag team match, successfully, against Drew McIntyre, I could see The Rock using his power of the board to influence Damian Priest into finally cashing in his money in the bank after the tag team match is over. And a bloodline beatdown, that probably would come also when the tag match is over. Priest comes out, he cashes in, he wins the world title. It would make sense with The Rock threatening to make Seth's title go to somebody else. That would be one direct way for The Rock to do so. He snaps his fingers, right? They work out a deal, an arrangement with the Judgment Day beforehand, and he gets Damian, after all these months he's been walking around with his lunchbox, he finally gets him to come out and cash in. But then The Rock wrapped things up here. He said, Cody Rhodes, for you and your crybabies and your new best friend, the walking clown emoji himself, Seth Rollins, and your goofy-ass dog, The Rock says this. You were all advocates of Cody finishing his story. It's so important. Cody, you took something from The Rock. You insulted my family. You took something from Roman Reigns. You took something from the millions and millions of people, of real fans who wanted to see the biggest WrestleMania main event of all time. You took it away, and now you're going to pay. Cody Rhodes, from the bottom of my heart, man to man, fuck your story. Glendale, Arizona, greatness is coming. SmackDown. Dallas, Texas, greatness is coming. You're on deck, March 8th. Memphis, Tennessee, March 15th. The Rock is coming home. Because The Rock did call Memphis home at one point early in his career. And then he ended with, if you smell what The Rock is cooking, Cody, fuck your story. So if you could get past all of the repeating that he did in that promo, and again, it was long. It was a 21-minute video. Even Cody responded to it and said it was so long he wasn't going to watch it, but he congratulated The Rock or I'm sorry. You know, whatever the meme is, like congrats to you or sorry, whichever it is, but he wasn't going to watch the video. But Rock, in that element there, he was in his backyard with his phone, cutting a promo. And it was great because we got to see Rock. Clearly, he's getting more comfortable in the heel role, right? Which was never something that he planned when he came back. He didn't think he was going to get booed. He didn't think that the people would boo the fact that they were going to do Rock and Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. But things ended up the way that they did. And I think they ended up better. Because now we get heel Rock, probably for the last time we're ever going to get heel Rock, and I don't think it's going to really last all that long, because I don't know that he'll be a heel after WrestleMania. So it may well just be another 4 weeks of heel Rock that we get. But now he's getting more comfortable in the role, and having fun with it, and it's a side of him that I find infinitely more entertaining than Rock the last few appearances he made before this all happened. Whether it was with Austin Theory in September, whether it was with Jinder Mahal in January, this is the version of The Rock that I find the most entertaining. And I like the fact that they finally did address the elephant in the room and they're trying to make sense of a nonsensical aspect of this story. At least they're trying. So I thought this was great. This is the best Rock promo in years. That took us into SmackDown later that night. With the Bloodline opening the show, we were 10 minutes into the show before Roman Reigns even said a word. He came out first with all the members of the Bloodline except The Rock. And he tried to get Glendale, Arizona to acknowledge him, and he wasn't happy with the response. And so he said, that's it. We're done here. And he told Paul Heyman, go get the jet fired up. And Heyman told him, well, you know, we can't leave yet because he's coming out. The Rock is coming out right after this commercial break. And Roman didn't look very happy about this. Rock came out after the break. He was, you know, again, dressed up like the Rock of old with the expensive, gaudy shirt. He got into the ring. Roman Reigns could not hide his disgust with any of this because he gave an order, and Paul Heyman defied that order because, oh, the bigger star, your cousin, is on his way out. So you could already see they're laying the groundwork for the next phase of this story. And so The Rock went out there, and I mentioned before about the Die Rocky Die sign. This segment was great in spite of all the censoring that nearly butchered the entire thing. Now, it may have been different for you if you were watching this internationally on another channel, but on Fox, they blacked out the screen multiple times. You could hear the audio, but they blacked out the screen because there was one person with a Die Rocky Die sign in the crowd, which is just fucking ridiculous. Especially when you consider some of the shit and the smut that this network airs on a regular basis and has aired in the past. And that will get the show blacked out, really? So that was idiotic. At least the audio stuff, when they chant, you know, fuck you, or they chant shit, you know, there's FCC regulations. I mean, that's annoying too, but okay, fine. You can kind of understand it. But all of the censoring, again, it nearly ruined the entire segment here. Now, Rock said that Glendale is 10 miles away from Phoenix, and he did some research, and apparently he said it's the number one city in America for cocaine and meth use. And he said, your life has meaning. Finally, you cactus-loving crackheads finally have something worth shooting into your veins. And he talked about how professional wrestling is cool again. Every city is sold out. Even this crack den with popcorn, it's all sold out. And it's all because of him. And then he turned his attention to Cody Rhodes, because Cody had challenged him to a singles match. So this was Rock's response to Cody Rhodes here after the social media video. And he talked about Cody thinking he's tough by challenging The Rock. You want your answer. Here's your answer. The answer is no. You're not getting your one-on-one match with The Rock. But he did have a counteroffer, because he said that he's a businessman, the bloodline, they're a bunch of businessmen. So he's got a counter proposal for him. He goes, Cody, you and your best friend, the walking clown show, Seth Rollins, on night one of WrestleMania, the biggest tag team match in the history of WWE and pro wrestling, Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins against Roman Reigns and The Rock. And I mentioned this on Friday. I thought back to Vegas when Triple H came out at the press conference and he talked about WrestleMania, and he, you know, put WrestleMania over in these grandiose terms, but he specifically singled out the first main event of the very first WrestleMania in 85, which was a tag team match. He mentioned Hulk Hogan and Mr. T against Rowdy Roddy Piper and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. And now that we have it official, I mean, it was pretty clear from the end of that press conference that we were probably going to get a tag match. It was just a matter of when. But that's the reason why he singled that match out. He specifically shined a spotlight on the very first WrestleMania main event being a tag team match. And now here we are, because they're setting up the biggest tag team match in the history of WrestleMania. And that's not just Rock calling it that. It would be. It will be. Just based on pure star power alone, the biggest tag team match in WrestleMania history is going to be Rock and Roman against Cody and Seth. Regardless of the quality of the match, right? We don't know yet how good the match is going to be. It should be very good, but it will be the biggest tag match they've ever had in the history of that event. But he said, it's not just going to be a regular tag team match. He goes, if you two jabronis beat The Rock and Roman Reigns on night one, then Cody, your title match on night two will be completely free of the bloodline. He said that includes Rock himself, Solo, Jimmy, and the Wise Man. Of course, he didn't say anything about the other members of the bloodline, for which there are many, many, many other members of the bloodline, but at least the names that he mentioned, he said, would not be allowed to interfere in the match, and Cody would have a shot then to finish his story one-on-one with Roman Reigns. But when The Rock and Roman Reigns beat your two candy asses on night one, then on night two, Cody, for your title match, it is bloodline rules. Anything goes. Said I could pull up a chair and call the match with Pat McAfee. Goes, maybe Solo wants to sing the national anthem, which the crowd seemed to be all in favor of. Wasn't there a video that Solo, he might have deleted the video or he took his social media private because people were spreading an old video of Solo from years ago, like at home singing, like singing in the kitchen or something. Wouldn't it be something if it turns out that Solo Sikoa actually has a good singing voice? But he said anything's legal. They could do anything they want to. So that gives them a lot to think about. He challenged them to meet him and Roman next week in Dallas to give them their answer. And that's the other thing I like, is the fact that if they're going in this direction, if they're going to use Roman and Rock, at least we're getting them on TV. Because one of my fears was Rock comes back to wrestle Roman, and we get him a handful of times, if that, on TV, because he's a busy guy, right? We've been through this before. But the fact that he is taking the time to actually be there on television almost every single week, you have to. You know, you got to keep the story interesting. He doesn't have to be on every SmackDown between now and then, but the fact that they've already announced him for three more is huge. And so that's good, because if they're going to build this entire story around these people, we need them on the fucking show. And that includes Roman, too. He said, if they don't accept their challenge, then the world knows that The Rock will do everything in his power to make sure that Cody does not win that title. He said he sits at the board, he owns it all, which means The Rock is your boss, and there ain't a man in the back that can do anything about it. No vice president, no general manager. The crowd chanted for Triple H. Now, Rock actually did mention Triple H by name. The reason I said that he didn't in my review on Friday is because it was censored by Fox. That's why I didn't hear it. I have since seen the uncensored version, and yes, he did mention Triple H. Very dismissively, he said, no vice president of who gives a shit, Triple H, can do anything to stop The Rock. I'm very much looking forward to the inevitable face-to-face confrontation between Rock and Triple H. Just for old time's sake. There's no way Triple H is having a match again, but could he get physical with The Rock at WrestleMania? Could he throw some punches? Could he maybe hit one pedigree? Yeah, it's possible. It would have to be limited, whatever. Like, I don't see him going out there and taking bumps. He could probably have some limited physicality. I just don't see him being cleared to do an actual match. But if we could get some physicality with him and Rock, I think that'd be pretty cool. I think that'd be something I'd like to see. Rock said, Cody, if you don't accept that challenge, The Rock and Roman Reigns will end your story tragically. And so the stage is set now for Dallas this Friday on SmackDown. He went to go do his sign-off. Roman stopped him. He cut him off in mid-sign-off. And then he took another microphone from Paul Heyman. He goes, I need something from you. I need this one thing. Acknowledge me. And Rock took his shades off. They stared at each other. Rock finally spoke up. He said, Roman Reigns, I acknowledge you as my tribal chief. And they shook hands. And then we got the sign off. And then they put their fingers up in the air. And again, Rock flashed the L sign with his fingers before he went to the one finger salute. He did flash that L again. Again, that's by design. That's not an accident. This entire segment ate up the first 40 minutes of SmackDown on Friday night. And it reminded me of the Tribal Court segment at MSG last year. It took up almost as much time, about 35 minutes. And I was glued to the TV from start to finish. That was one of the best television segments, if not the best one, on WWE TV all year. This segment was very similar in that way, that all the censoring aside, as annoying as that was, it was very compelling. I was never bored. Yes, they drag out the entrances. There's a lot of dead time here, but this is what WWE is. It's about the grandiose entrances, the big stars. Their fans eat it up, right? I mean, look, that's the way it is in WWE. It may not be that way in other companies. It doesn't make it right or wrong. That's the way WWE has always done things. I don't know why this is surprising to people. I don't want to see WWE become AEW, and I don't want to see AEW become WWE. I don't really understand why there is still such a back and forth over, well, this is the way that things should be done. I can't believe that this went this long and they dragged it out this way. Yeah, I'd be more offended if the segment sucked or if it was boring. But if they can send these guys out there and talk for 40 minutes or talk for 30 minutes and have 10 minutes of entrances and keep it compelling, then I'm fine with it. That doesn't bother me. And it accomplished a lot of things. It accomplished the challenge for night one, which is going to be accepted. And so now we know it's going to be a tag team match. We have stipulations, so it's not just a tag team match. Now there are actual stakes here. I think it actually makes the outcome more predictable, not less predictable, because I cannot imagine them doing the Roman and Cody match on night two without trying to replicate the finish last year. With Solo hitting the spike on Cody, you put the fear of God in all the Cody fans. Oh my God, not again. Only for Cody to kick out this time, right? It's such a missed opportunity if they don't do that. Of all the times for there to be bloodline interference, and I'm so over it because the playbook is just so played out at this point. But of all the times you're going to have bloodline interference, this is the one time that it would make all the sense in the world to have the bloodline interfere and throw everything they possibly can, the kitchen sink, at Cody, because I think Roman is losing. And if there's going to be a title change and Roman is losing, then yes, they should have interference and they should be desperate and trying different things to make sure that Roman can keep his belt. If Seth defends his title on night one and works twice that night, that could come into play here too. He could come into the tag team match hurt. This is the man that's been going around for the past 9 months. I got a broken back, right? He's walking around like an old man. What was the other injury? He's got the knee, right? He's about to be cleared from his knee, so he had a knee injury. He's got a back injury. He could come into that match as the walking wounded. That could play a role in the tag match. If Cody has to go it alone, it's basically turns into a handicap match, and that could be their out for losing. And then what do we get on night two? We get absolute anarchy in the main event under bloodline rules. It's going to be completely overbooked. If you are not a fan of overbooked matches in wrestling, this is not going to be the match for you. There are right ways and there are wrong ways. There are good ways and bad ways to do an overbooked match where it could be fun or it could be total shit. But if they're going to do it, just go crazy with it. Go all the way with it. So long as nobody wins the title for Cody, that's the one thing I don't want them to do. That's the one thing they cannot do. The worst thing they could do is have somebody else do something that wins it for Cody Rhodes, or physically attack Roman Reigns, and that directly leads into the finish, right? They could clear out the bloodline, they could neutralize The Rock, make it a fair fight, but Cody needs to win on his own merits, not because a bigger star came out and helped win it for him. The other thing this segment did, it furthered the tension between Rock and Roman, which sets up their inevitable match, which I assume is WrestleMania 41, but who knows? You know, it could be a multi-match series. They could wrestle at SummerSlam. We don't know where things are going to go there. It probably will be WrestleMania 41, though. But the little things they did, the look on Roman's face, him calling him out at the end and saying, I need something from you. It was gnawing away at him the entire time. I need you to acknowledge me. And then Rock did, but it felt completely insincere. So this was great. I mean, they are telling multiple stories here. I thought this entire segment from start to finish was excellent. I know there are varied opinions about it, but I thought it was excellent. And now it feels like this story is back on solid ground, heading into WrestleMania. And then once things play out at WrestleMania and the main event is over and one story ends, there's this other story that can go in any number of directions. And one of those directions could involve future members of the Bloodline, which leads into this other story. Tama Tonga wrestled his final match for New Japan last weekend, after 14 years with the company. On the same night that Okada wrestled his final match, so too did Tama Tonga. He is the nephew and the adopted son of Haku. The best thing you will see all week is not Rock's promo. It is the video that Dark Side of the Ring put out on their social media channel showing Haku sitting down watching the Shockmaster video. They showed him the Shockmaster video for the first time. He had never seen it before. And they got his reaction on video. I have never seen that man laugh so hard in my entire life. Seriously, make sure you watch. If you're having a bad day, it will help lift your spirits. The belief now is that Tama Tonga is on his way to WWE. It's not often they sign somebody that's 41 years old although they have plenty of 40-year-olds on the main roster right now. But they have been there for years, right? He hasn't been. This is his first time coming in. And he's one of the founding members of Bullet Club with AJ Styles in WWE and Finn Balor in WWE and Anderson and Gallows in NXT at the moment. There is the potential to do something there with him, you know, kind of Bullet Club related. But there's also a very good chance that he ends up with the Bloodline. Now, I know some people, well, he's not Samoan. Why do people keep saying this? He's not Samoan. No, he's not Samoan. I love how some people just automatically think that anyone from the islands is automatically Samoan and part of the same family tree. He's not. But Lance Anoa'i is. Actually, we just had him on the House of Glory show last night. He is the grandson of Afa the Wild Samoan, son of Samu. He did an interview recently with Steve Fall, and he said that the Anoa'i family considers Tama Tonga one of their own, as they do Haku. Rock has long considered Haku to be his uncle, even though they have no blood relation. So Lance says that it has more to do with all of them being from the South Pacific. So as Islanders, they all kind of stick together like one big family. So even though he may not be Samoan, I mean, look, neither is Paul Heyman, right? Paul Heyman doesn't have a drop of Samoan blood in his body. So it's not crazy at all to think that Tama could end up in the Bloodline. I still think that Jacob Fatu will end up with them at some point. If WWE wants to, they can keep the Bloodline going for years, just in different incarnations, like the NWO, or like Bullet Club. There have been a lot of different incarnations of Bullet Club, and different leaders of Bullet Club. NWO had less success. The more versions of the NWO we had, it was the law of diminishing returns there. But that could be what the Bloodline is to WWE if they want it. Even after Roman loses the title at WrestleMania, I think the Bloodline will live on in some form or fashion for a while. They can keep milking this thing just by rotating different people in and out. Some other news here. In January of 2022, MLW filed an antitrust lawsuit against WWE, which I covered here pretty extensively on the podcast, alleging that due to predatory actions taken by WWE, MLW's business was at risk of being irreparably destroyed. And they accused them of sabotaging deals that they had in place with Vice TV and the Tubi streaming service to air MLW programming. And contract tampering as well. They accused them of contract tampering with Swerve Strickland and Davey Boy Smith Jr. The big thing they claimed to have evidence of was Stephanie McMahon directly interfering with their Tubi deal, which led to that deal being canceled. It's actually the night before the press release to announce it was going out, and they ended up canceling the deal. And Tubi is owned by Fox. So WWE had the Fox deal with SmackDown, and there was pressure put upon Tubi not to do business with MLW, so they didn't. Discovery would have been very messy for WWE, and they knew that. So they settled in December for an undisclosed amount of money. We didn't know for how much. We only knew that there was a settlement. We didn't know how big or small. Until now. Because in TKO's annual earnings filing for last year, they noted the following about the lawsuit. On January 11, 2022, a complaint was filed against WWE by MLW Media LLC, alleging that WWE interfered with MLW's contractual relationship with certain media platforms and engaged in other anti-competitive and unfair business practices in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act and California law. On December 22, 2023, the parties notified the court that they had entered into a settlement agreement in the amount of $20 million and stipulated that the case should be voluntarily dismissed with prejudice. In light of the settlement, the case was dismissed with prejudice on December 26, 2023. So a $20 million windfall for MLW. Vince McMahon paid that much in hush money payments. This was basically hush money paid to MLW to make them go away. I would consider that a big win for them. Now let's see how they make use of that money. Sean Spears is back. He's back in WWE, though, not AEW. And he's going by the Sean Spears name that he used in AEW, not the old Ty Dillinger name that he had in NXT. But he made a surprise return to NXT on Tuesday. Ridge Holland was in the ring cutting a promo. The arena got dark. And there was a vignette that played on all the video walls. There have been these mystery messages for weeks now that have been played. And there were a lot of theories about who this was for. It's for Okada. It's for all different kinds of people. And then a hooded figure attacked Holland with a chair from behind, which I thought was very appropriate because remember the gimmick that he was doing in AEW? He was the chairman. Right? He always walked around with a chair. And then he revealed himself as Sean Spears. And then while exiting the building later on, he cut a promo. He promised to show up at this week's Roadblock episode. So that was a big surprise. They managed to keep that under wraps. He announced in December that he was leaving AEW. He had been there really since the very beginning, the first event in 2019. Last time we saw him on AEW television, he was in a battle royal on the All Out pre-show in September. And this is not his first time in WWE. He had a couple of runs there, including the Ty Dillinger run. But it's a win-win for him because he gets to be closer to his family. I believe he lives in Florida. His school is in Florida. He runs a school called Flatbacks with Tyler Breeze. So I don't see how this is anything but a win for him. I'm happy for him. I think it's the best scenario for him. And apparently he's a good trainer, and so I think he could be of value at the Performance Center as well. I think that's the right place for him to be. Now, there's one other thing I wanted to talk about, and then I'll go through some questions here. This became a story this week, and I don't quite understand why. But it became a story. I guess the reason why is because wrestlers made a big deal out of it. There was a video clip that surfaced from a WWE house show in Oakland, California from a few weeks ago, showing Maxine Dupri. As she was leaving when the match was over, she was being heckled by some fans who were... It was a small number of fans. It might have been one fan. I don't know how many people were actually saying, "You suck." But someone said, "You suck, Maxine." But she was getting booed by a lot of fans as she left after her match with Nia Jax. And Rhea Ripley went on Twitter and she said, "I wish that some of you got booed and ridiculed in the public eye while being new at your job. And learning and getting better is all part of being human. Be better as humans." And Zelina Vega said, "This is horrible." And they're probably just mad because they can't drink your bathwater. I'm sure that's the reason. And then a bunch of other wrestlers tweeted stuff in support of Maxine Natty and Britt Baker. I think Chelsea Green. And look, I think that's great. They want to support their coworker. I don't think that there's any malice involved in the people who were booing Maxine. Maxine Dupri was put on WWE television way sooner than she should have been. She is not ready to be in the ring on television. She's not. She's not. And anybody could objectively watch her and say that she's not ready to be in the spot that she's in. It's one thing to be on TV and be a valet. They want to have her as part of the Alpha Academy. They want to create this character for her on TV. I think that's perfectly fine. The minute they started putting her in the ring and having matches, I know it's part of her gimmick that she's in the Alpha Academy and they're teaching her and she's learning. But the fact is, you're going to send her out there, she's going to have matches that are not going to be that good. The people have a right to boo and cheer whoever they want to. I saw the video clip. I thought that somebody must have said something horrendous to this woman. Some kind of a slur. They called her a nasty name. And when the clip was over, I said, is this like the edited, like, brief version of a more, like, uncut clip that I'm missing here? Is there, like, a full clip that somebody can share with me? What am I missing here? Where's the issue? Where's the controversy? No, it was just that this woman got booed. One person, at least one or two people, said, "Hey, Maxine, you suck." As she was walking to the back, she looked very sad. Because I'm sure, look, yes, I'm sure it's very disappointing to her to get that kind of reaction. This is a non-story. I don't see what the issue is here. Now, if somebody had paid to come to a show and they use some kind of derogatory word, or they're using cuss words, and there's little kids around, like, there are things like that that I can understand. Like, all right, come on, don't be a dick. Like, that's completely uncalled for. Booing and cheering is part of being a professional wrestler. It's not her fault that they put her on television too soon. But guess what? She's on television. She's working house shows. And I hope that she continues to work house shows. House shows are a great vehicle to improve your craft and work with people who are better than you at what you do so that you can be brought up to their level. That is the value in doing house shows. And I think she needs to continue to do those. But there are countless wrestlers, male and female, over the years who have had far worse things chanted at them. And I'm not condoning it, but I'm saying that it's part of the wrestling business. And a lot of those people got better and they turned around. And guess what? They threw it right back in people's faces. And hopefully she can do that too. Hopefully over time she'll improve and she'll get better. And she won't have to deal with that kind of reaction anymore. But to turn against the fans and say that these people are bad humans, be better, how dare you boo this woman? It's called professional wrestling. If you can't deal with being booed, you're in the wrong business. Go find something else to do. That's where I have an issue. Attacking the fans for booing and not reacting in the way that you want them to react is so fucking ridiculous to me. And they can rally around her and support her. I think that's great. I'm sure she's a lovely girl. Not saying anything about Maxine on a personal level. If it were me in the crowd, I wouldn't be booing her. I would probably watch the match and say, boy, that match sucked, because she's had some really bad TV matches where she just is lost and a little clumsy in the ring because she's not experienced enough to know what she is supposed to be doing. They have a performance center for people, a multi-million dollar performance center for people just like her. So blame the company for that. It's not her fault, but that doesn't mean that if she goes out there and has a bad match, the people don't have the right to boo or say you suck. That is their right. And when we get to the point where wrestling fans are the bad guys for booing people and saying, hey, you suck, I mean, what are we talking about here? What has happened to wrestling that the fans all of a sudden now are the heels because they dare pay to go to a show and boo somebody who they don't like or who they think is not really all that good? Maybe that's the fans' way of sending the company a message. You ever think about that? Maybe it has less to do with Maxine and more to do with, hey, why are you putting these people out here before they're fully cooked? Because you're not doing her any favors either. Right, I mean, think about it, right? Maybe they're sending the company a message. What's so bad about that? God forbid the fans should send the company a message and let them know how they really feel, right? We can't have that. No, the fans are the bad guys, of course. The fact that this even blew up into a story this week is fucking ridiculous. If it were a tweet, it would win for sad tweet. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Don't boo me. Carlos, save me. Carlos from New York. With Roman and Rock going over on their time on SmackDown, causing SmackDown to be altered to a degree, do you think WWE should alter the layout of their shows to lean more towards in-ring action as opposed to overly relying on being promo-heavy? No. No, that's not what WWE has always been about. The entertainment aspect of things. They've always been very promo heavy, more so than heavy on the in-ring action. Again, that's not the way Raw and SmackDown are meant to be constructed. That's not what's getting SmackDown 2.5 million viewers every single week. All right, yeah, very good matches on SmackDown, but you've got The Rock and you've got Roman Reigns and they're selling their story for WrestleMania. And a lot of the WWE fans are more interested, frankly, in going out there and seeing Rock on the show doing whatever Rock is going to be doing, healing it up, talking about Cody. If Cody were out there, which he will be next week, you know, we're going to get another segment. It may go 30 plus minutes. And I'm sure their fans are going to be eating it up and the ratings are going to be through the roof because that's what their audience wants to see. That's not what Fox paid them $1 billion for, is to just put on banger matches every week. Their shows are formatted in the way that they're formatted for a reason. That's just how they do things. I think that there are other aspects to their formatting as far as their positioning of commercials that I wish were different, because the commercials are, you know, in the middle of matches are very disruptive. I don't know that they necessarily have control over that when it comes to Fox. You know, Fox may slot their commercials in where they're going to be and WWE has to work around it. They may not have a say in that. Same thing with USA. But no, I don't think that constructing the shows to be more in-ring heavy as opposed to promo heavy is anything that they are going to do, or frankly, that they have to do. And if that's the sort of thing that you want to see more of, that's the beauty of having a product and an alternative like AEW, because they do tend to be more in-ring heavy than promo heavy. That's why you want to have options. That's why competition is a good thing. Variety is the spice of life, as they say. And I don't like spicy things, but I like variety. Neil from Chicago, how would you feel if CM Punk was the special guest referee for the World Heavyweight title match at WrestleMania? It would be a bit of a complicated way to get there, but I think you could explain it via the contract of the night one WrestleMania main event match. Maybe there is a stipulation that was added by Paul Heyman without the knowledge of Roman or Rock. This could be the start of friction between the bloodline, or at least the removal of Paul from it, as well as hinting to a reunion between Punk and Heyman. In the match, we could see a repeat of SummerSlam 97. In this case, CM Punk reluctantly counts the pinfall for either man. And he says, I think it would make more sense for Drew at this point if he resigns. What say you? I don't think that Punk can really be involved. I mean, it's still not that long after he had tricep surgery. So physically, I don't even know if he's got a bad wing. You know, is it the arm that he would use to count three? Like, we have to consider the fact that there's a reason why CM Punk is not in a match at WrestleMania this year. He physically may not be able to do much. I mean, I think he'll be there. I think Punk may be there. I think Punk could host. You could have Punk as the host of WrestleMania. But if nothing else, maybe he could be out there to do commentary. Could he get involved? Could he distract Drew McIntyre or in some way cost him the World Heavyweight title to further their feud? I could see that. That's possible. Him being the referee is not something that I see. And Paul Heyman not being in the bloodline is something I don't see. I think he's going to continue to be with this group for the foreseeable future. Blake from Sydney. There's something bothering me about the damage control storyline, and I would like to get your thoughts on it. The story has kind of shifted to Io just being a jerk, when after last year's WrestleMania, the story was Bayley using Io. She went as far as to literally push her off a ladder at Money in the Bank, and Io forgave her for it. And after that, manipulated events to force her to defend the title in a triple threat match. Now the story has shifted pretty unnaturally to Bayley sacrificing herself for the group, and they're kind of making out like Io has turned on Bayley for no reason. And it's like everybody just forgot or are ignoring the past of this storyline. I understand that it's really the best story the women have on the show right now, but I can't pretend that there is not this glaring part of the story that they are ignoring. I feel it would be better if they acknowledge Bayley's actions and let the fans pick who is in the right. What do you think? I think they want Bayley to be a babyface. That's what I think. I think they specifically don't want people to choose. I think the whole plan was to have Bayley go babyface, and effectively, it's almost like a double turn in a way. You know, not the best example of a double turn, but you can kind of look at it like that. You know, again, it's been almost 5 years since Bayley has been a babyface, and I think that they wanted to do a shift in her character. So it wasn't about giving people a choice. You make a good point. That really is where things seem to be headed. Bayley seemed to be... There seemed to be an underlying jealousy. It wasn't explicitly stated. But there seemed to be this underlying tension and this jealousy on Bayley's part. And the story did shift in a different direction. So you make a good point there. But this is the direction they wanted to go in. And the fans have taken to Bayley as a babyface. And so I don't... I mean... You know, this is where I think they wanted to end up the entire time. There was just a shift in the direction of the story. It's as simple as that. But you're not wrong. You're not wrong in that it felt like it was going one way and then all of a sudden it went a different way. And, you know, you could always explain it by saying that Bayley had a change of heart and really at the end of the day wanted to do what was best for the group, and whatever jealousy there may have been, she got over it for the betterment of the group. She put the group ahead of her own ambitions and her own feelings, right? I mean, there's a way you could explain it. They don't have to, because, I mean, we're at a point now where Bayley is firmly entrenched as the babyface. Dakota just turned heel on her the other day on SmackDown. Like, they're not going to go back and try to explain little, you know, plot holes like that. It's not as big as the plot hole with Rock and Cody, for example, which, you know, had to be explained. But I don't think you're wrong. I think that's a fair point. Tori from Atlanta, I wanted to know your opinion on Paul White, the Big Show. He's been in the business for over 25 years, won all of the major championships in WWE and WCW, excluding the international title, and is one of the modern era's best big men. With all of his accomplishments included, he still does not seem to get acknowledged the way that an Andre the Giant is. Do you think that the Big Show is one of the best big men, or does he lack some key essentials to be seen at a higher level? Well, he has two questions. We'll start with that one. Big Show is not the attraction that Andre the Giant was, so you can't compare the two. There's really no comparison there. Andre was a traveling attraction, the first real traveling attraction in the wrestling business. He went to different territories and different promotions. He always drew. And then he settled in WWE, and most people probably remember him from the latter years of his career where he wasn't very good and he wasn't very mobile and his health declined. I mean, his health deteriorated pretty rapidly because of his disease. But he was the very definition of an attraction. Big Show came up in an era of weekly live television. And so you couldn't really, I mean, you could, but they didn't hide him. They didn't, only put him on television every blue moon. They overexposed him. He was as overexposed as all the other big names from the Attitude Era and the Monday Night War period. And so you can't compare. It's like apples and oranges. One was an attraction. The other one wasn't an attraction in the same way. As far as his accomplishments and should he be seen as one of the best big men, I think he'll go down as one of the better big men. I mean, especially when he was younger, he was a pretty nimble guy. You know, he was a pretty agile guy. He was trying certain things at the beginning of his career that people like Hogan told him, don't ever do that again. You know, nobody that looks like you should be coming off the top rope for a missile drop kick or trying a kip up or a moonsault because you're a giant. And there's a certain way that giants are supposed to wrestle. And so he was very athletic. He did let his health and his weight get away from him there for a while in WWE. That's when they de-pushed him. I mean, his weight got really bad and his health was not doing well. That's why he left the company in whatever year it was, 2006, 2007. I mean, he'd be on the list, I think, of one of the better big men in history. I would not put him at the top of the list. And I can't rank him in the same conversation with somebody like Andre as far as being an attraction. It's just, I think, a product of his time. If Andre had come up in the same period that Paul White did, it would have been the same thing. Andre wouldn't have been an attraction. He wouldn't. He would have been a big guy, but he would have been just another guy like everybody else who gets overexposed on television. And probably would have been involved in some pretty piss-poor storylines, like Big Show was. The other thing that works against Big Show is all the number of times that he turned from babyface to heel and back. It's either him or Kane, right? They have to have... I keep forgetting which one has the record for most turns. It might be Big Show. I don't think that did his character any favors either. Now, Tori's other question is, do I think if he did not don the Goldust gimmick for the majority of his career, that Dustin Rhodes could ever have been pushed as world champion like his brother Cody is? No, I don't think Dustin Rhodes ever would have been world champion. Not that he didn't have the talent and the ability to be a world champion. You know, in some ways he kind of reminded me of a Barry Windham, but I just didn't think he had the same kind of charisma that, you know, you would expect from someone in that top spot. He had a different kind of charisma when they turned him heel and he did the Goldust thing. He really just embraced that character. But like the natural Dustin Rhodes as a world champion, I don't see that. I don't see it. James from Louisiana, I was curious about this story of Owen Hart and why the Blue Blazer resurfaced. I had heard through Cafe Renee, I guess that's Renee Dupree's podcast, that Owen apparently was saddled with the Blazer gimmick because he refused to do an angle where he cheated on his wife with Deborah. Is there any truth to that? And what were the plans for the Blue Blazer had he not met his tragic death in 1999? There have been stories about that. Well, let's back up a little bit. So, yes, there was a storyline pitch. Vince Russo has confirmed it. There was a storyline that Russo and WWE pitched where Owen would have an affair with Deborah, and that would cause a rift between Owen and Jeff Jarrett. And Russo has said the reason that he wanted to do the story is he thought with Owen and his personality, it can almost be like a comedy story. He thought it would be hilarious. And this is according to Russo, that Owen went to him directly and said, I can't do this, because Martha would just pitch a fit. Like he, because of his wife, he said, I can't do that. Even though it's a storyline on TV, I can't do that story. And that doesn't shock me at all. That sounds exactly like the kind of person that Owen was. You know, he would have been very uncomfortable with that story. Now, according to Russo, he said, that's a man right there. Like, that's a man that supports his wife. And I said, no problem, then we're not going to do it. And it was dead on the spot. Does that mean that Owen didn't have some heat from Vince McMahon and the other people there? Like, oh, he's not being a team player, so we'll show him. I don't know. I don't know the timeline of events when that was pitched and then when he became the Blazer. If it happened one right after the other, then yeah, maybe there's some truth to that. But as far as I know, yes, that is true, but he didn't have heat because of that. It was that Russo and them were trying to come up with something funny for Owen to do, and they thought it would be funny for him to go back and do the Blue Blazer gimmick. Now, if I remember, I think they did an angle with Owen and Dan Severn on TV where he hurt Severn. It was almost like, I don't remember if he hurt him in the same way, like with the same move that he hurt Steve Austin with. And Owen was very dejected that he had injured somebody, and I think he went away and came back, and that's when the Blazer stuff started. My timeline may be off. As far as what their plans were for him as the Blue Blazer, he was going to be the Intercontinental Champion. The night that he died, he was going to win the title from the Godfather. How long he would have held it for, how long he would have continued on with the Blue Blazer gimmick, we'll never know. But in the short term, the plan was to put the title on him, so they obviously had some plans for him. And Mark from Bonn, Germany. A couple of days ago, I heard Conrad Thompson and Bruce Pritchard having a conversation about why they don't have WrestleManias at MSG anymore. As I was listening, one question comes up to my mind. It seems that they held WrestleManias in bigger venues from X7 onward, and then stopped at WrestleMania 20, 21, and 22 to be held at MSG, Los Angeles, and Chicago. I thought, okay, maybe they did 20 in New York for nostalgia, but what about those other two? As they could easily have been held in bigger venues as well. So do you know how that all came about? I always figured that, and I think this had to be the way that they did it because it would be too much of a coincidence, that the second WrestleMania was held from three different locations. Those three locations that WrestleMania 2 was held from were New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. And so I thought that they were doing 20, 21, and 22, kind of a playoff of that, because they went New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, back to back to back. But I know that years ago there was a DVD, or like a documentary that came out. I think it was the real story of WrestleMania, or the untold story of WrestleMania. And it was Basil DeVito, or one of these people that at the time worked behind the scenes for WWE. And they said that Vince McMahon wanted to do those specific cities for those WrestleManias before he went back to doing stadiums again. Like, there was something, because WrestleMania in the early days was in those cities, that's where he wanted to do WrestleMania, and then they would resume doing the bigger buildings, which they did for 17, 18, and 19. Now, 19 did not do well on pay-per-view. I mean, they had 50-something thousand people at Safeco Field. I don't know what the capacity was that they were looking for. I don't know if ticket sales were considered a disappointment for that WrestleMania. I know pay-per-view buys were. Pay-per-view buys were a real disappointment for WrestleMania 19, and I still don't have a great answer for it, because you look at that card, it's a pretty stacked card. You know, you got Austin and Rock, Jericho and Michaels. This was Michaels' first WrestleMania match in many years. Angle and Lesnar, and you had Vince and Hogan. I guess people just didn't want to see Vince and Hogan. I don't know. They pushed Vince and Hogan like that was the real main event. So if you're going to blame the main event of the show, don't blame Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar. Blame Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan, because you would watch the program and the hype for that match, and you would never know that the actual main event of the show was not Hulk Hogan and Vince McMahon. But in any event, I think they just wanted to do those original cities. And you talk about doing like an outdoor stadium show or an indoor stadium show. I don't know what indoor stadiums were there in Chicago at the time that could have run WrestleMania if they wanted to do a Chicago WrestleMania in a stadium. And then I could do Soldier Field and fucking early April. I mean, now maybe they would, but I can't imagine them doing that back then. So that is what really just makes the most sense to me. You know, Vince just wanted to go back to those original cities, and those were the venues that were available to them. And then once that played itself out and they got to 23, it's like, all right, back to the big buildings, right? WrestleMania 3 was in a big building. In fact, WrestleMania 23 was also in Michigan. It wasn't the Silverdome, but they were kind of following that pattern of those past events. And now they don't follow any pattern of past events, because now it's all about bidding and who can pay them the most money and tax breaks and that kind of thing. It's like the Olympics now. You have to have cities bidding on WrestleMania. The tradition died at 30 when they took it and put it in New Orleans and not Madison Square Garden. That's when I knew, okay, the tradition is over. 30 and 40 going back to where it all began, that's just not going to be a thing. So 30 was in New Orleans, 40 is in Philadelphia, 50 will be in some other city not named New York. Now it's just a different ballgame now. Anyway, keep emailing me. Good stuff. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. And follow me on Twitter as well. I'll be live tweeting during Revolution tonight at SolemnMonster. Join me as soon as the pay-per-view is over, because you're getting two podcasts today. I'll go live as soon as AW Revolution concludes. We'll talk about Sting's final match and all the other happenings on the show tonight. And then back here next Sunday for episode 852 of the SolemnMonster Sounds Off. Until then, be well, stay safe, and I will see you live on the streams this week on YouTube. Until next time, take care, guys.
The SolemnMonster Sounds Off.
Cody and Seth is not the answer. The answer is Cody and Roman. I mean, it is all set up. It's like you sit down to have dinner, you tuck the napkin into your shirt, you got your fork, you got your knife, everything is lined up. It's like Thanksgiving. You got the turkey in the middle of the table, there's the giblets and the gravy, and you've got the fucking pink shit over there, whatever the hell that is. The stage is set, you go to dig in, and instead, you got like chicken tenders for the little kids at the table. And so you go to the chicken tenders, and you have the chicken tenders instead. Why the fuck are you eating the chicken tenders when you have all this adult food in front of you, just set up right in front of me? You can pig out right now, have the biggest feast that you've ever had in your life. You reach out to get chicken tenders that you steal from the children at the table. Eat what's in front of you. It's delicious. It's like filet mignon. You're reaching over for the chicken tenders. I don't understand.
The SolemnMonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the SolemnMonster on Twitter at SolemnMonster.
SolemnMonster.
SolemnMonster. SolemnMonster Sounds Off.